Christmas on Talk Radio. Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
That looks like I've arrived then. They've given me my own jingles. Well, this is unusual, isn't it? The Unexplained is normally where I am on Sunday nights, but over the Christmas period, you're going to be hearing significantly more of me, if you can bear that. It'd be lovely to have you on this show. If you want to call me, I'm going to get this out there up front and at the very beginning, 0344 499 1000. That's our phone number here. You can also text the word TALK, that's T-A-L-K, and your message to 87222. If you want to tweet like you normally do when I'm on The Unexplained, then you can do that too by tweeting at Talk Radio. Karen, producer, is here. Sam, technical producer, is behind the glass doing his stuff. And Jonathan, one of my regular listeners, wherever I go, is listening in Worthing tonight. Jonathan, it's nice to know you're there. But
Happy
be nice
Christmas,
to hear you.
Christmas, Jonathan.
Karen. Karen is producing all
Hi.
Of this. So what I want to say basically is, you know, I'm just a hired hand here, right? So if anything goes wrong tonight, it's K-A-R-E-N. And I'll give you the full email address so you can complain later.
If but anything gets played out in the wrong order, we can play Sam.
But equally, we have to say that if it's a great show, then Karen's the producer.
Absolutely. You know, all credit in my direction.
Well, as my grandmother in Liverpool used to say, Howard, you've got to give credit where it's due. A bit of deja vu, if that's the word, bit of deja vu tonight, because this takes me back to when I started in radio. I've survived for decades in all of this, God knows how, doing various things. I was a news guy, so wherever in the UK you happen to be, you might have heard me on your local radio station over the years doing the news, because that's what I used to do. You know, I don't do that sort of stuff these days, only occasionally. But my very first gig in Liverpool on a big station there, I was a kid. And I'd only just finished journalism training. And they decided the way to break me in was to put me across the entire holiday overnight, in the days when they did overnight news on big local stations. So I was in charge. And the boss came to me when the rotors came out. And he said, put his hand on my shoulder. And he said, right then, lad, it's Christmas with the stars for you. So that was my Christmas many years ago. So this kind of, you know, it feels quite similar. So what are we going to do tonight is a very good question. It's going to be a bit of a mix. It's not going to be entirely unexplained. There's going to be a bit of that in there, which I will explain. The unexplained, I will explain. But there'll also be, you know, a lot of other stuff like Christmas telly. We'll be talking with an expert on Christmas television about how Christmas telly now is different from the glory days. Or maybe it isn't. Because there are elements in Christmas television this year that you might have not seen if you haven't looked at the schedules that actually take us right back to the days of people like Morecambe and Wise and stuff like that. So we'll talk all of that through with a TV expert, Mike Ward, who's often on this station, later in the show, not yet. On the weird side, when I say weird, that's a little uncharitable, Howie. Come on, that is Christmas. On the strange side, on the unexplained side, we're going to be talking to a woman in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, who says, and you might have read this story in your papers, that she, how do I put this, that she married a pirate. A 300-year-old pirate.
How do you do that?
In a very, I'm glad you asked that, Karen. You see, that's why you're here. she married a pirate in a plush ceremony on a boat, with a medium presiding over all of it to interpret. Because obviously, somebody's got to be able to say, "I do." So she did that. But relationships, you know what they're like. If you've been through a few in your lifetime, they're all milk and honey. Some of them. And sometimes you think, this person is not quite what I thought they were. This is exactly what happened to this woman. Amanda Teague is her name. She discovered reasons why the pirate was not exactly what she thought he was, so she now wants out of this.
What, not a pirate?
No, he's definitely a pirate. Although he doesn't speak like a pirate. You're robbing me of my material here. It's not talk like a pirate night, although it can be if you'd like it to be.
Well, no more surprises. Let's save it.
Well, no, let's save it. It's coming soon this hour anyway. So she's decided that it's not quite what she thought it was going to be for reasons that you will hear. So you've got to stay tuned and hear why. And we ask all sorts of questions like, was your marriage consummated? And we get the answer to that, which I won't tell you now. So that's in the strange side of things. You'll also be hearing a little bit later, a little bit from an earlier interview that I did, that you seem to like, with a guy called, there was one, a guy called James R. Hansen, who wrote the book First Man, that the movie about Neil Armstrong, First Man, that is packing him out at the cinemas even now, was based on. He is an amazing guy, so we'll hear a little bit of him in the final hour. And then we'll be doing something that I always think is nice to do at this time of year. We'll be going round the world talking to various old chums of mine, which Karen has been trying to set up over this last week. You've done a wonderful job, Karen.
Oh, thank you. Working on my holiday as well, wasn't I?
Exactly. I mean, but it's all done remotely now because, you know, we all work. I've been recording interviews at home and Karen's been setting up people to talk to at home. So
it was almost like we were opposite ends of the country, really, wasn't it?
Well, in fact, we were, but that's a whole other issue. So we'll be talking to a couple of old friends of mine who I haven't talked on radio for years, who are in one of the most Christmassy cities on the planet, Chicago, Illinois, where the winters are cold enough to freeze your eyebrows. That's not a joke. They can freeze your eyelids shut or open if you step outside at the wrong time. And they know how to celebrate Christmas. Steve and Johnny are radio legends in New York, in Chicago, and they work on a radio station called WGN. And they used to feature on my radio shows that I did in other places. I haven't spoken to them for 10 long years, so it's high time I caught up with them. And we'll be finding out about Christmas in the Falkland Islands with a guy who works on radio there. And I'm just generally shaking it up. Also, Jono Coleman will be here from Sydney. Jonathan Coleman of the telly and the radio fame in the UK and Australia. We're going to be talking about how they are celebrating Christmas Day there coming soon.
On a beach.
Well, there's going to be a certain amount of that, but Jono has had a bit of a year that we'll talk about. But also, he's just moved into a new house. And on Facebook, those of us what know him and those of us what follow him, we've been watching this whole move, and the move is culminating, if that's the word, around about now. So he's moved to a fab part of Sydney. And has got an amazing house with a swimming pool, and the weather's incredible. And we're going to find out what Christmas is like down there. And I think that's more or less everything, apart from the fact that...
Oh, you missed one.
What have I missed? Don't tell me. What am I not doing here?
Clayton.
Oh, we're going to talk. Yes, yeah. The first person we're going to speak with is a guy called Clayton. He's a real-life, you tell me, astronaut, yeah?
Yes.
And I came up with this idea. We're going to find out what it's like to be on the International Space Station. And up in space.
And I found the guy.
And you found a guy called Clayton Anderson, who was a real life... Well, do you know what mission he was on, Ben?
I'm not sure, but I'm sure he can tell us all about it. And about... Also, we're going to chat to him about the recent missions to Mars as well.
Okay.
There's been a guy called Bill Anders been doing some comments.
Well, you're peeking too soon.
Yeah, I am peeking. But about his comments about... You know, how he thinks NASA is wasting money on maybe sending human missions to Mars. So we're going to ask Clayton about his thoughts and should NASA be doing it? And does he think we can put human life on Mars?
Okay. All right. Well, we've almost done the thing now. So that's coming up this hour. We're also going to do a little bit of old-fashioned, because you liked it the last time. When I was being Ian Lee here a couple of months ago, we came up with what I thought was a cheesy old idea first. But it was one of those ideas that flew. You know, one of the most successful things I ever did on radio in the days when I worked with Chris Tarrant was that one Christmas we went in to do the show, and I think we were all a little hungover, and we didn't know quite what we were going to do. And somebody had a book of TV trivia, and we started firing out questions, and I thought, this is not going to fly, and the lines were jammed. So, you know, another thing that works really well is Beat the Intro, where you play a couple of beats of a well-known record, and you tell us what it is. We're going to use Christmas records this time, and you can call up, and if you fancy trying to beat the three of us, that's Sam behind the glass, Karen, who's sitting with me here, the producer, who must be obeyed at all times for that question, or myself, Howard. I'm just here making up the numbers, really. You can do that as well.
No,
if you want to come on and talk about your Christmas, if you've had a row or avoided one, if you've got a Christmas hero, I'd love to hear about somebody who's already made your Christmas, okay? It happened for me last night, and it's what gave me the idea to do this. I was getting the train home. On Sunday nights after the unexplained, I get the very last train out to take me home. And if I miss that train, then I'm either sleeping on the pavement or I'm walking 16 miles home. So I managed to make the last train, but I'm sitting there along with about 40 other people on this train at Waterloo Station in London. And it looks like the train is not going to go anywhere. And we're looking at our watches, and it's like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 17 minutes. Are we ever going to leave? Then we discover that our guard for that train, and these trains need guards, hadn't turned up for work. So we're thinking, oh, God, here comes replacement bus. It's going to be 2 hours home, and I need this like a hole in the head. Suddenly, out of nowhere, comes my hero for Christmas. This is a guy, and from his accent, I think he was Spanish. He might have been Italian, but I think he's Spanish. And he said, OK, I'm on this train to go home. I'm a guard, and I'm going home for Christmas. What I will do is I will make sure that you all get home. He said this on the tannoy, the announcement system there. And this guy did one extra shift, one extra little gig, to get all of us home last night. And if he hadn't agreed to do that, off his own bat like that, we wouldn't have got home. So I don't know your name. I never will. Thank you very much for doing that, because you saved all of us who were on that train last night a lot of hassle. So that's my hero. If you've got somebody who's made your day, make my day, it's one of my range of voices that I do. I'm available at very reasonable rates. It's one of those things that made my day. If you've got something that has made your day and somebody who's been really nice and you didn't expect it, then let's do that. You know, I'm going to chuck out all that news stuff, all the Brexit and all the other stuff that people go on and on and on about. We're not going to do any of that tonight. So I hope that's all perfectly clear. It's a bit of a mix, isn't it? With me, Howard Hughes. Nice to have you there. And I'd love to talk with you tonight. So here we go. Christmas Eve into Christmas Day on Talk Radio.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen.
Howard Hughes on Christmas Eve into Christmas Day on Talk Radio across the UK. Really nice to have you there. Tell your friends that I'm here, because they'll be well impressed. No, trust me. And if you're listening in any part of the world, if you're one of my regular unexplained listeners in different parts of the world, nice to have you there. Let me know that you are by tweeting or texting or whatever. Somebody's left a copy of the Daily Mail in here. The headline says Clueless. They've heard the show already. Okay, we're going to talk about space. One of the ideas I came up for this show tonight is, what is it like at this time of year to be, for example, on the International Space Station, where you're there with, you know, your colleagues who you've got to coexist with for months at a time, whether they're from the US, Russia, the UK, wherever they're from. But Christmas is a peculiar and different time, isn't it? If you ever had to get on in a small environment, if you had to be friends, if it had to work for you, then space is the place where Christmas is focused in on, perhaps more than anything else. Man who knows all about this is an astronaut. My producer, Karen, found me a real-life astronaut. Clayton Anderson is a NASA man, an astronaut himself. He's online to us now here at Talk Radio from Houston, Texas, the city of my namesake, Howard Hughes. Clayton, thank you so much for doing this on Christmas Eve.
My pleasure. Merry Christmas to everyone.
And Merry Christmas to you too, Clayton. What was your part in the space program?
Well, I had a 30-year career at NASA in Houston, Texas, 15 as an engineer and 15 as an astronaut. I did two trips to the International Space Station. One lasted 5 months. One lasted a little over 2 weeks. And did six spacewalks in my career. So.
Six
very
spacewalks.
Proud, honored to be a NASA astronaut.
That is astonishing. And two trips to the ISS. Did you do your spacewalks from the ISS? Presumably you did.
Yes, all six were done from the ISS.
Okay, I wasn't going to ask you this first, but when you step out, I've only ever had the chance to ask this of one other person, and that was Edgar Mitchell, who I was lucky enough to speak with not long before his death, and it was a privilege to speak with him. When you actually step out into the void, what does that feel like?
Well, it's a unique environment, to say the least. In wearing about a 500-pound spacesuit, you're very cautious. You move relatively slowly, and as you become more acclimated to that environment and your suit and what you're out there to do, it actually becomes quite thrilling and quite fun.
Yeah. Is it frightening at times, though? It must be.
I don't know if I'd use frightening. I had some anxiety, right? Mm. You don't want to be the astronaut that makes a mistake, right, that loses a tool or breaks something or makes an error that someone else is going to have to correct later. So I was very fortunate in my six spacewalks. Everything went very well, and I guess I was most anxious about doing the right thing and not screwing up.
Because when you do the spacewalks, you do them for a reason. There is something to maintain. There is something to install. There's a reason for doing it. But there must be a temptation, even though every minute is spoken for and every minute's accounted for, to have a look over your shoulder, look back at Earth, or look out into the vastness of space. You must have done that.
Oh, absolutely. The nice thing about a spacewalk is, as you say, it's choreographed nearly down to the minute. But if you get ahead on a task or you have a question on a task and perhaps the ground control team has to take a few minutes to discuss and give you an alternative solution, you do get a chance to take a break and look around. And also, we try to force astronauts to stop for a moment and look around and take it in, because it is one of the most spectacular scenes and scenarios that you can even imagine.
I can't imagine. I suppose all I will know is video footage and film footage that I've seen. It must be a tremendous thing. And I suppose you also feel that it's a great privilege to be there because of the general population, the population US, UK and the world, very, very few people ever get the chance to do that.
Yeah, I think today the number of space flyers is around 550 or 560 people in human history. So It is a small cadre. Hopefully with commercialization of space, maybe you will get a chance to go up there.
Well, exactly. I mean, what do you think about Mr. Branson's latest efforts? He's run a test firing, hasn't he? They've got 51 miles up, which is pretty much space, almost. I think 60 miles is space, isn't it? But 51 miles up. And they're going to be taking fare-paying passengers quite soon. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think that that's a great start. But unfortunately, he's charging $250,000 to do what Alan Shepard, the American astronaut, did back in 1961, essentially. So I'm hoping that the experience gets better and the price gets lower really, really fast.
Now, the one thing that people who go on the ISS, the International Space Station, they tend not to talk about and they tend not to be asked about is the human thing about getting on together, perhaps feelings of loneliness, missing your family, reconnecting with home, wondering what you're doing up there, all of those things. I guess that if you're allowing yourself any of those feelings when you're up there, then Christmas is the time when you're going to feel that most, I would have thought.
Yeah, I think that I did not spend the Christmas holiday in space, but I'm pretty aware of what those that did experienced. And the nice thing is as a crew in space, you are very close. There's typically no battles or no problems, no issues. You know, everybody works together well, independent of what country they hail from. And the holidays are set such that we choose American and Russian holidays that, you know, you don't get every American holiday, but you also don't get every Russian holiday. But holidays like Orthodox Christmas for the Russians and our Christmas for the Americans, those are both celebrated. And it's a great time to take a little day off and have a great meal and just spend some time sharing fellowship and being and talking with your family, which is also very fortunate for crews today. They can video conference with their family on Christmas. They can send email notes. They can make videos and exchange videos. So it's a lot nicer than you might think, except for the fact that you're not physically with your family.
But you can't exactly celebrate, I presume. You know, you can't, for example, have a bottle of wine or, you know, champagne or something like that up there. You can't do what people down here do.
Well, to a certain extent, you cannot, but there are things that don't get revealed.
Oh, really? Can you reveal any of them now?
You can read my book, The Ordinary Spaceman, and one is revealed in that book.
Could you give us a taster, or would that be giving too much away?
A taste is probably a very accurate description.
Oh, really? Oh, so yeah. You do. Okay. So there might be some alcohol consumed up there. And if does it affect you?
There's a static.
No, you know, if a hypothetical astronaut was to try a hypothetical glass of something hypothetically alcoholic, would it affect them differently up there?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that the astronauts are highly professional.
I'm sure they are, but it's just interesting to know the effects of all things are different in space. I wonder if that's different. You can't tell me, can you?
It could be.
Okay, one question that my producer's come up with, and it's a good one, is when you're celebrating holidays like Christmas, of course, we haven't reached Christmas yet. We're a couple of hours away from Christmas Day. You are going round the Earth. At what point do you declare Christmas? Do you declare Christmas at the point when it would start East Coast USA or in Moscow? How do you do that?
Well, that's a great question, and it just depends. The Russians will start it, for the most part, based on when their family is celebrating. So, really? Russia's 9 hours ahead of the U.S., I think, and so their day starts a little earlier because they're going to want to get on the internet phone and call their family and friends. And so they're able to do that while in America, it's still folks are still sleeping. So the nice thing when I flew with two Russians were that they would use the telephone system to call their family and friends typically in the morning, and then I would have access to it in the afternoon.
Okay. Right. So, as we say, it's all about getting on with people, and everything has to be apportioned. You've got to share it all out.
Absolutely. And now the meal the crew will celebrate with will happen on the station timeline, which is roughly Greenwich time or your time there in London.
And you talk about a meal. You can't have turkey and the things that you would have in the U.S. and here in the U.K. Presumably you've got to have little things in plastic packets, have you?
But you have turkey, and you have dressing, and you have green beans with mushrooms, and you have cranberry sauce, and they do a nice job with the American menu to provide those kind of comfort foods that remind people of the holiday feast they might have on Earth.
One of my listeners, the Doctor, who always makes good points, and he's just made one here, is NASA tracks Santa Claus, who, of course, has already started work here in the UK, around the world. That's in full swing tonight, isn't it? It's been going for years, I think. They're tracking
Absolutely.
Santa Claus from NASA.
Yeah, the folks at NORAD, which is our Colorado-based tracking station, they're going to give updates throughout on where Santa's progress is taking him. And so far, so good, is my understanding.
Well, this is good. In the news today, there is a guy called Bill Anders, lunar module pilot of Apollo 8, which we were remembering on my show last night, The Unexplained at Talk Radio. Apollo 8, 50 years ago across Christmas, there were astronauts around the moon and reading from the Bible. Bill Anders was the lunar module pilot on that mission, and he has said, and I quote, to an interview here in the UK, it's stupid to plan human missions to Mars. He said that the first human spaceflight to leave Earth's orbit said sending crews to Mars was almost ridiculous. What do you think about that? Is it the right thing to do to send people there and put them at all that risk and spend all that money? Or can we do everything that we could do to learn about Mars by using robotic craft and probes and things like that?
Well, the one thing I don't think is you can't do it with just robots. I think that we need to do everything we plan to do with space exploration with a combination of humans and robots, because the human advantage is to be able to see, assess, respond, and react to a situation, which I don't believe a robot is going to be able to do, at least with today's current technology. Now, Mr. Anders, I understand exactly what he's saying, in that I don't think I agree with him that it's stupid, but I do agree that it's going to be expensive, it's going to be difficult and dangerous, and we need to go there for the right reasons. I'm not a fan of abandoning Earth for whatever reason that people think we're going to need to abandon it eventually. But I do believe that anything we do in space, no matter where we go, leads to technology development that we can use back here on Earth. And that's the most important thing I try to encourage people to think of in America, at least, that going into space is an investment. Because it's not where you go, it's what you learn along the way.
And we've seen the fruits of it over many, many decades, all the way back to Apollo and even before that. We're looking at Mars now. People claim that they see all sorts of things on Mars, and a lot of people think that they see the potential for life maybe even a civilization having existed on Mars. We'll know more when InSight probes down, I think it's 16 feet down into the surface. That's happening very soon. So we'll learn a great deal more about what's down there. What does your gut tell you about that, Clint? Do you think that it, when we actually probe what the surface is like, what the rocks are composed of, perhaps some of those ice areas, what do you think we may find? Might we find life or even the building blocks of it?
Well, we certainly might find building blocks of life. But for me as a human, the only species on a single planet in our solar system, in the Milky Way galaxy, in our universe, I often feel like we're a little isolated. I think that the what we have to continue to think about is that we, and for sure me, I don't have a great grasp of a time frame of billions of years and the things that could have happened and might have been over the billion-year period. And if we can find some building blocks, I think those are will be interesting things to study and investigate and try to figure out, and we just have to take it step by step. But again, all of this will be quite expensive. It will require the support of the human race, not just America or Europe. To do things like this.
Apollo 14's Edgar Mitchell, very famous man, sadly no longer with us, told me that when he stepped onto the moon, for him, that was his wow moment, the moment that he stepped out there and looked at the terrain. In your 30 years of being in space, what was your wow moment?
Well, I love Ed Mitchell. I got to meet him one time. I have a lot of respect for what he accomplished. And that would be a great wow moment to step on another celestial body. I didn't get that opportunity, but I guess my wow moment was the first time I exited the airlock hatch on my first spacewalk of my entire life as the lead spacewalker, going outside with a gentleman from Russia and performing for 7 hours and 41 minutes. I mean, that was wow for me.
Nearly 8 hours of doing that. I can't even imagine what that must feel like. Exciting, scary, the culmination of everything you trained for, all of that stuff going through your head at the same time. When was that, by the way? What year?
It was in 2007 on July 23rd.
You're not going into space now, are you, or are you still going up there?
No, I retired from NASA in 2013. I was told that I would never get any more flying opportunities, which was extremely disappointing to me, given that I thought I was pretty good at it. So I reluctantly retired. I've written 3 books. I teach part-time at Iowa State University, and I'm on the lecture circuit. So I have a good life since being an astronaut, but boy, I would love to go back and spend some time in space if I could.
You sound to me like I'm reading between the lines of a man who misses it like hell.
I miss most of it, right? There's certain parts I do not miss.
which include?
Broken toilets in space.
Oh, my God.
That would be at the top of my list.
So when the toilet breaks, you know, I mean, it is Christmas, and we have to be a little delicate about these things, and we are British, but when the toilet breaks, what do you do? Do you just kind of keep a smile on your face and hold it?
Well, you know, my earliest memory in 2007 was Oleg Kotov, the Russian cosmonaut, floating down to the American segment and telling me, Clay, I have some bad news. The toilet is broken. And I looked at him and I said, I just ate lunch.
Oh.
And but the goal is you get it fixed before anybody needs it. Mm-hmm. And if you can't get it fixed in that time frame, then you have to either go to the Soyuz capsule and use its very rudimentary toilet system, or
you don't want to do that.
No, you don't. And but even worse than that would be having to resort to the Apollo poop bags.
No, I can understand that would not be ideal. So what we've learned tonight, I think, among other things, is that the worst words you can hear in space are, perhaps from one of your Russian colleagues, the toilet is broken. It almost sounds like one of those Cold War passwords, doesn't it? You know, it's springtime in December and the toilet is broken. It's an absolute pleasure to speak with you, Clayton. Clayton Anderson, and can I wish you and yours in Houston, Texas, a very happy Christmas.
Oh, yes, and Merry Christmas to you and all the people on the good earth.
Ah, the words spoken 50 years ago this very weekend, and Christmas Day from Apollo 8. Clayton, thank you so much. Howard Hughes here on Talk Radio across the UK, round the world, and also out in space now. If you want to come here and talk about what your Christmas has been like, or if you've got a hero, somebody who's given you a fab Christmas already by doing something really nice for you, or anything really, or how you avoided having a great big row in the kitchen because you disagree on how the turkey should be cooked, you're perfectly welcome to come on here. You know, I'm not here that often, so it'd be nice to speak with you. 0344 499 1000. This is Howard Hughes at Talk Radio.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
Well, I'm reliably being told that that is Latvia's Eurovision entry in 2008. Sam, doing the technicals tonight, did it win? Did it get anywhere? Did it get an all point? It could do better. Fantastic. Sounds like the Russian Navy chorus, doesn't it, really? One of the reasons we're playing that is it's sort of appropriate for what we're going to talk about now. This is a recording that I did earlier this week, because it was the only time that we could get her. A story that's been around the news over this week or so, and you might have read it in various newspapers like The Sun. Headline, if a 300-year-old pirate ghost can't find love, who can? This is the story of Amanda Teague from Northern Ireland, who married a 300-year-old ghost of a pirate, nicknamed Jack, in a ceremony that guests could only describe as bizarre. Actually, he didn't speak like that, as you'll find out. But now Amanda has discovered this man, this ghost, this entity, is not quite what she thought he was. And she wants out of the arrangement. So I caught up with her a little earlier this week, and this is how our conversation went. So obviously, Amanda, I've seen this story. And first of all, let me say, you know, commiserations. I'm very sorry. How are you now?
I'm still dealing with health issues, still dealing with trying to dissolve the marriage on both levels, legally and spiritually. So it's far from over, unfortunately.
You say there's a legal process involved, but you married a ghost. So did you have a legal ceremony that you got into and you got to get out of?
Yes, we actually did. We had a legal ceremony. We discovered that it was actually legal to marry posthumously or to marry a spirit in some countries in the world. There was no precedent for the law here in the UK or Ireland because it had never been done or requested. So on doing some research, we found a registrar, or legal officiant, who was prepared to perform a spiritual marriage. So what we had decided to do, or how we did it, we went out into international waters. He came out on the boat and performed the legal ceremony and signed the paperwork. So in the same way someone would go to, for example, Las Vegas and get married and then come back and register as married with the documentation, that's exactly what we did. So, of course, because in that case you really only need the paperwork to say that you were married, it's easy enough to register it. For a divorce, it's a lot more complicated because you literally would have to go to court and stand in front of a judge. And I can't see any judge in the UK accepting a medium speaking on behalf of the deceased partner.
Well, you found a preacher who was willing to perform the ceremony. Maybe you might find the judge. But in the ceremony...
Maybe Judge Rinder.
I should have had that thought. That's a great thought, Judge. I wonder if Judge Rinder would do it.
Even know if he's a real judge, but yeah, it's worth looking into.
Absolutely. Absolutely, he is. He's a very clever man. But look, in the actual ceremony itself, when you got to the bit where you say, I do, isn't that a bit difficult for the other party involved?
Well, what we did, we sourced a medium who would channel. Channel is a form of mediumship where the spirit enters the body of the person who's speaking for them and speaks through the person. So we organised a medium. It was actually the registrar, the officiant, who put us in touch with a medium who could do this, because verbal consent is an important part of the marriage ceremony. Without verbal consent on both parties, then the marriage can't be considered legal.
Okay, so if a medium got you into this, can't a medium get you out of it?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that because, as I said, you have the legal element of it, which obviously has to be dissolved legally. Now, we're looking more into the whole annulment area than the... than the divorce, because you can get an annulment if the marriage was entered into without full knowledge, or you feel that you were somewhat deceived into doing something that you weren't aware of the full consequences of. So that's what we're looking into to dissolve the marriage legally.
Okay. And how would you? What would your grounds be then? Why were you deceived, or why were you not aware of the full consequences, Amanda?
Well, I wasn't aware of the full consequences, first of all, by the person who performs the marriage, because along with being a legal registrar, they are also part of the spiritual path that believes in spiritual marriages. There is obviously another ugly element to making a soul contract with the spirit, which I suppose we'll go into when I talk about the spiritual element of it, which was not told to me whatsoever. In fact, I consulted many different people on the pagan path, mediums, people that have been on this path for 40 years. And only one person told me that they thought what I was doing could somewhat be dangerous and have consequences. Every other person told me it was totally fine and safe. So in a way, yes, I do feel that I was very badly misled without being told the consequences of what could happen.
I mean, I suppose one of the biggest consequences is not a spiritual one, but it's just people not understanding and perhaps thinking that you're mad.
In it, but I mean, I think I'm kind of at an age where I am now. The people that know me, my friends, my family, know I'm not. They know the type of person I am. And actually, I'm quite a logical person, really, underneath it. If it doesn't make logical sense to me, then I don't believe it. So I'm not so much worried about what other people think. It is more really the fact that I was deceived, and the fact that there's so much out there in the spiritual world, like tarot cards, Ouija boards, or spirit boards, as they're called now, people going to mediums, all this kind of thing. And they don't know that there's another element to it. It's all portrayed as being love and light and safe. And it really isn't. And I've learned that the hard way.
Okay. Well, I mean, how many men and women have I known in my life who said, I don't want to be with this person anymore because they're not what they thought they were. I thought they were. And that's basically what you're saying, but about something that you believe is a spirit.
Yes, indeed. So to talk about the spiritual element, I guess you're going to have to kind of go back. I mean, if you don't believe that anything exists in the spiritual world or outside of this realm, then you're not going to believe any of it. If you do believe, whether you're Christian or you're pagan, or no matter what denomination you are, there is such a thing as negative entities.
All right, well let me put my tarot cards on the table here. And, you know, I do think that there's something more. You know, I have a feeling that there's something more than we see because, you know, life has kind of taught me that. But I might be wrong. I have to say that actually falling in love with, meeting, and ultimately marrying a spirit is a bit of a stretch for me at the moment.
Well, I guess it kind of depends, as I said, you know, where people are coming from and what their perspective is. I mean, if you read the Bible, this talk in the Old Testament of incubus and succubus, which is are spirits that have sexual relations with humans. So that's from a Christian perspective. Mm. Forget about going back to, you know, tribal path, shamanic, Native American, all of those other, you know, paths or whatever. You know, that there is, you know, talk, or there is certainly evidence that relations between spiritual entities and humans have existed for a very long time. Take, for example, even that film The Entity, which was based on a true story about a lady called Doris Blyther, who got a very negative attachment that continuously raped her. And I mean, that was a very, very, very big case over in America. So I mean, this isn't the first time that there has been something about a spirit and a human being having an intimate relationship.
I'm trying to find a nice way of putting this, and here goes. Was your relationship, your marriage, consummated?
Yes.
Okay. I can't even begin, and we can't even discuss how that might happen, but you believe it was?
Yes, and it's the same as somebody, say, they go to a haunted building and they say they get a shiver up their spine, or they felt something touch them that wasn't there. If you go to a medium for a reading, sometimes the medium will say your loved one just kissed you on the cheek or held your hand, and sometimes people can feel that energy.
Well, I mean, it's a bit more than a shiver up the spine, though, isn't it?
It's the same way, except that you develop this ability to feel the energy in obviously a much more detailed way.
I've got it. So if you feel that happened, then it happened.
Yes.
Got it.
All of this was done through mediumship. I mean, I don't hear his voice physically. I've never seen him physically. This is all done through different forms of mediumship.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's wind it back slightly then, because I should have asked this before now, but the rest of it is so fascinating. How did you meet?
Well, I got involved in the spiritual path back in 2010. So I would have been practicing various elements of spirituality, like communication with the dead, forms of witchcraft. So I would have been doing this for a number of years before I encountered the spirit of Jack. So it was 2015. I was just doing one of my meditations or journeyings, as we would call them. And this spirit came into the circle or to my area. It was my home. And I asked it to leave because I was quite aware that they're not all spirits are love and light. So if somebody comes in uninvited, your initial reaction is to ask them to leave. So this happened twice, and both times I asked the entity to leave. The third time the entity came in and tried to communicate with me, I decided that I would engage and ask who it was. And when he told me who he was, my initial reaction was, no, this isn't true. So I guess this is another lesson. Always go with your initial gut feeling.
And what did he tell you? I mean, first of all, you know, what's his name and what did he say about himself?
Well, first thing he said was that I'm dead, you know, and I was, yes, I know that. And then I asked who he was and he told me his name was Captain Jack Sparrow Teague. So I was... No, I don't believe this. So there was two elements. First of all, it could have been a deceptive spirit. And the second thing was the fact that I was always been very interested in this whole era of piracy. I was writing a book about it. And I also did some charity work as a Jack Sparrow impersonator. So the other question was, have I gotten too deep into this?
Yeah, in other words, is this impression coming from my mind, not from spirits?
Yes, exactly. So I cut off contact and that was it. But pretty much nearly every single time that I would open up to do any kind of spirit work or communication, this guy, Jack, kept coming in and kept trying to communicate with me. So finally, several months after this had been going on, I finally said to him, well, if you are who you say you are, then you're going to have to prove it to me. Like, can you give me some evidence? Because I just don't believe this. So he had told me various things about his life and his time. And I had gone away to try and research them. And I really couldn't get any points of verification, because it's difficult to find points of verification for someone who's dead 300 years. So the thing that finally made me believe him was when he told me that Teague was in my maternal family tree. So that technically he was an ancestor of mine, and if I went and researched that I would find this Teague in my family tree.
And you didn't know that up to that point?
No, I didn't know that. I only really knew Glavy and McGowan, which were like my grandparents' maiden name and married name. So I had never heard of this Teague. So went away and started to do some research into my maternal family tree, and I found that three generations back there was in fact a Teague. So that's when I kind of said, well, okay, I kind of do believe you, because I personally didn't know that. So that couldn't have came from my own mind. So that's when we started to communicate on a regular basis. And I suppose I started to trust him. Then we started to communicate on a very regular basis and several times a week. And we got to know each other very well, because, like I said, I was very interested in the whole era of piracy. I do believe that I had a past life in that era. And I was writing a book about it. So I found him very fascinating, and I was very interested in the things that he had to say and his whole backstory. Because although he had told me that the character from the films, Jack Sparrow in the movies, was somewhat based on his, you know, on him as a spirit, obviously it's not the same person and he's not the character from the movie. So his own story was quite different to the story of the character. So a few months later, I mean, we'd spent so much time communicating, I actually realised that I actually had feelings for this spirit. And I mean, I had never at this point heard of a spiritual relationship or a spiritual marriage or anything like that. So,
You must have thought it was an unusual relationship, though, because you couldn't exactly go to the pictures with him, could you? You couldn't go down the pub with him.
No, well, there had any kind of real talk of that. It really was just communication at this point. You know, when I would have been doing spiritual work, it wasn't a matter of, you know, we were going out together or anything. It was just really communication, the same as, you know, you would communicate with other spirit entities. And anybody who practices that kind of path would know what that means. So people will communicate with our guides or with angels. And it was that kind of communication. It was all very, very professional, shall we say. So I really didn't do anything about it. I was just like, this is weird. In a sense, almost like somebody that would have a crush on their friend's husband or boyfriend, and you're just like, well, I can't do anything about this. So, you know, I'm just going to leave it where it is.
Well, you know, a lot of people would think, you know, well, it is weird, so they wouldn't go any further with it. But you did.
And I guess that's where I was at that time. So it was January 2016 that he first suggested to me that if I felt that way about him, that we could, in fact, have a relationship. So, again, I had to go off and do my research. And that's when I started to approach other people in the spiritual world, people that I'd studied under, mentors, and people that I would have had a lot of respect for and I felt would have had more knowledge about these things than myself. Some of them, when I approached them, told me that it was quite common. And some of them had sexual experiences with spirits. And they were all very, very supportive and said, yeah, I think you should go for it. So so that's when I decided, well, you know what? Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's go for it.
I mean, if you're thinking about, you know, sometimes you know, people get together with other people who turn out to be a bit high maintenance. At least I presume somebody who's in the spirit world and a pirate from the spirit world from 300 years ago would be pretty low maintenance.
Well, this is what you would imagine. It kind of worked for me in the sense that I would identify as being on the asexual spectrum. Mm-hmm. So the whole physical element of a relationship has never been a big thing for me or something that I was really that into. So I had been single for quite a while before I had met Jack, and I wasn't really looking for a relationship. I'm quite independent and I was quite happy in the life that I had. So this kind of, for me, would have been a perfect relationship because I had a partner, but I didn't have the whole physical element in it. So for me, it seemed just like, you know, the perfect solution, really.
Okay, but it wasn't completely unphysical, if that's the way to put it, because as you said, the relationship, the marriage was consummated.
Well, intimate, I would use rather than physical, because obviously he doesn't have a physical body. It is feeling energy. So, so yes, we were intimate, but not physical, because he doesn't have a physical body.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
Oh, yes, it always is, you know. Thank you for your communications, Sally, Roger and John. All points noted. I'm getting the feeling that not everybody is entirely buying into what Amanda Teague says here about marrying a pirate from 300 years ago. And it all being spiritual, and that she's, you know, she's happy for it to be that way, which is just as well, really. But if we get time for it, later in the show, we'll hear part two of that conversation with her. Roy's online to us here at Talk Radio. How are you, Roy?
I'm very well, thank you, Howard, and good evening, and Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you, Roy. What do you want to say?
Yeah. It's a point of order, Mr. Hughes, as they would say in Parliament.
Hey, what have I done?
I've listened to your shows for many years, as you've explained, and listened to all your podcasts.
There's a but coming, isn't there?
Well, I know you are. You like accuracy.
Yes.
It's in relation to your friend Paul Sinclair from Yorkshire. You regularly talk about the unusual goings-on on the Bench and Cliffs and Bridlington up the east coast of Yorkshire.
I do, and he does, mainly. Yeah.
As the old East Riding of Yorkshire.
Yes.
Well, there's nothing old about it. Bempton and Bridlington are in the East Riding of Yorkshire,
So they still call it I thought it was one of the older areas. It is actually, that's a real admission, isn't it?
Bempton is very close to the North Yorkshire border, but Bempton and Bridlington and Hornsey are all, and Driffield are all in East Yorkshire.
And do they call it the East Riding? Do they still call it the East Riding?
The East Riding of Yorkshire, yes.
Embarrassed as hell.
Stanhead, just to above Bempton in the north, but it is the East Riding of Yorkshire. And every time I hear you refer to it, I say, Howard, that's not the case.
Well, thank God you told me now, because I'd keep doing it. Roy, that's very good of you, my friend. Whereabouts are you exactly? Where are you?
Well, I live in Northumberland now, but I lived most of my life in not many miles away from Bridlington.
Okay, and how do they spend Christmas in Northumberland then? What are you going to be doing for Christmas?
Not a lot, just with family. Quiet, very quiet indeed.
Okay.
Family, that's all.
It's strange,
because I regularly used to travel from Hull to the East Coast to a place called Withernsea. And I quite often used to see bright flashes in the sky over the coming from the North Sea, but out at sea.
So those people, and this is one of the things that, if you didn't hear him last night, and the many interviews we've done with him, Paul Sinclair reports...
I haven't listened to your show last night yet, no.
I mean, you must listen to it. It's also appearing as a podcast, an extended version at my website, theunexplained.tv. You'll see it there. But one of the things that people consistently report when they look out to sea into the North Sea, and we're talking sometimes about hardened trawler crews have been at sea for years and seen everything, are strange flashing lights. And sometimes objects that nobody is able to explain.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I say, I used to drive east from Hull. It's all very flat. The area is known as Holderness. You did an article on ghosts, I believe, in a place called Burton Pidsey near Withernsea a few months ago. Uh-huh. But they used to be strange, frequently see strange lights, a little bit like sheet lightning. Really bright flashes.
Well, Roy, listen, do me a favour. Two things. Number one, have a happy Christmas. And number two, if you get time, tell Paul Sinclair about this, because he's gathering all this information.
Well, I tried to at the UFO conference, but he was busy with a lot of people.
All right, email me through the website and I'll put you in touch. Roy, thank you very much. Have a great time. That's Roy in Northumberland, regular listener to my Unexplained show, which is all good news. Coming next here on Talk Radio with me, Howard Hughes, we're going to be talking to John O'Coleman about Christmas in Sydney, Australia.
Festive free speech with all the trimmings.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
When I was young, wearing white trousers, a yellow T-shirt, and a smile on my face. And I had highlights then. Of course, now I've got nature's highlights. Howard Hughes here at Talk Radio across the UK. Listen, if you might think, I heard that years ago. What's that song? It's Ryan Paris, La Dolce Vita. I like to mix it up here. Sally, thank you very much for your tweet. The answer to your question is, it's all about experience. It has to be, really. And Roger, nice to hear from you here across the UK on Talk Radio. Well, we've got an hour of Christmas Eve still to go, but there is a place on this planet where it's already Christmas Day. And it has been for hours. And that place is Sydney, Australia, residence of my longtime friend and sometime radio opponent. Well, I won't say opponent. He was across the street on another radio station when I was on another radio station. John O'Coleman is here. How are you, John O?
Very good, Howard. Merry Christmas to you. Ho, ho, ho. And Merry Christmas to all the listeners this morning as well.
So what time is it in Sydney then? Is it breakfast time or what?
It's breakfast time. It's just after 10 o'clock Christmas Day morning here, Tuesday morning. Santa has been. We've just been out in the park with Banjo, our spoodle dog, walking around the big park at Rushcutters Bay where we live in Sydney. Oh. And it's right on the edge of the water where the Cruising Yacht Club of Australia is, where the Sydney to Hobart Yacht Race starts tomorrow, Boxing Day, every year for the last 75 years. The yacht race has been leaving from Sydney Harbour and making its way down the coast of Australia, past Victoria, past Tasmania, and they're stopping at Hobart. So the Sydney to Hobart Yacht Race, a very full-on yacht race for adventurers, and there's crews from Hungary and Germany, the UK and America. So it's we're very, very lucky where we live, and it's an absolutely picture-perfect day here today. Oh. 29 degrees and blue skies as far as the eye can see.
I'm not even slightly jealous, John, but I've been looking at pictures. You've been posting pictures for your followers and for people like me on Facebook and various places of this new home of yours. It looks as if it's built into the side of a cliff top, and you've got the pool there, you know, just, and you can lie, you can lie back in the pool and look at all the things that you've just been talking about.
It was all those years of doing very early morning radio shows in London for Richard Branson and various other people like that man, Chris Wright, who had the one. And I don't think I ever got a chance to work for Capital Radio, but now we're all, you know, we've always been very friends, as you know. And Russ and I have just reacquainted after many years, so now we're doing Russ and Jono rebooted podcast. So it's like old home week, as we say.
Well, I always thought that you and Russ and Jono was always one of the great teams on air. And of course, as you say, back in the days when London radio was big, we were sort of rivals, but friendly rivals, because we kept meeting each other at award ceremonies and stuff, and taking the proverbial out of each other. But they were great times. Do you ever regret, going back to Oz then? Yeah.
We've been back in Australia full time since 2007. But saying that, we were in London earlier this year, Margot and myself and our daughter Emily, who's studying in Germany, and we got a FaceTime call from her. So she's in London at the moment at the Mayfair Hotel with her boyfriend and the boyfriend's dad. So it's very sort of cool and 2018-ish. So she's having a traditional London Christmas, a UK Christmas. My sister is having her usual Christmas up at near Coventry with her husband. So we've got like one foot in one continent and one hemisphere and one foot very much so here by the blue sky and the sun. And saying that, though, as you were just saying in the news about this giant tower block, which is near the Olympic Stadium at Homebush when they had the Sydney Olympics in 2000, that all started creaking and cracking. Imagine this on Christmas Eve. Everybody was.
That's an astonishing story. It's made the news here. Those people who live in that tower block, they were just preparing for their Christmas and they started hearing the block creak and shake, I think, didn't they?
Yes. It was. I was doing my radio show yesterday when the story broke, and we're going, this is just a terrible thing to happen. I mean, echoing of the horrific things that went on in London with that tower block, of course, that we all used to drive past so many times on the way to and from work and everything. But that's why they were evacuated soon. So basically, it's Christmas Eve evening, and suddenly all the police and emergency services are saying, grab your stuff, you've all got to get out of the building while engineers check it. And it has actually, they found quite a bit of cracking on the sort of from the 12th floor up.
What a terrible thing for those people, but thank God they found it, and thank God it kind of alerted them by creaking and they were able to get them out of there. But they always used to say, I did news for years, that news is no respecter of public holidays and stuff like that, so bad things tend to happen at the least convenient times, and those poor people are experiencing that.
It's so strange how it is, whether it's a tsunami, which is, the terrible news of the tsunami that happened the other day. We've had, even in my time when I was working on the radio here, time there was the big problem that they had, the hurricane and the storms that in Darwin wiped out Darwin one Christmas many years ago. And there was a song that was very big. It's called Santa Never Made It to Darwin. And a lot of people died that because they didn't have the adequate building controls and stuff, which they of course have now. But, famous people seem to, shuffle off this mortal coil and drop off the perch around about Christmas time. I mean, even Shakespeare, he died on his birthday. Your listeners and yourself, the family, a very merry, safe and happy Christmas. And from up here on the balcony at Rushcutters Bay, we're about to go up to the other house later on in the week, because basically they've only just moved in there and it's full of boxes. So it's got that swimming pool. I can stand in the swimming pool and look out at the pit water. But at the moment, there's a lot of boxes and the bed is just a mattress on the floor. So I thought we might as well have a couple.
It's all part of moving in. But it sounds like you've got a beautiful end to the year, Jono. And how's your health now, Jono? Because you made the news everywhere with that this year.
It's about 99% cancer-free. I was told that I had cancer in 2016, and I've undergone chemotherapy and acid radiotherapy, still on hormone therapy where I get an injection in my stomach once a month. Mm. And I had a test a couple of weeks, and my PSA also right down to 0.21.
Oh, well, that's excellent. That really is.
I'm basically
basically 99% there. But, you know, for the rest of my life, I'm going to have to be vigilant. And I would advise any other of your male listeners, over or even 50, just get that regular blood test to check your cholesterol and to check your PSA levels, because there are no, you know, you don't really realise that you've got prostate cancer, or you don't realise you've got this cancer, that one, or testicular cancer. You've really got to go and search it out for yourself. Once you're over 50, like us young bring chickens, you've got to get checked. The earlier they find something, God forbid they find something, but with me, they just said, oh, it looks like you've got a cancer, there's one on the side of your prostate, and large, and it should be. And I didn't know where the prostate was until the doctor showed me.
Well, you know, it takes a lot of bravery for a guy and for you to go to the doctor and say, I think I've got a bit of a problem. A lot of us just, you know, we just prefer to ignore it, don't we? And that's where it becomes an issue, because if you ignore it, it can do for you.
I did a bit of that as well. I mean, like, I've done my fair kind of, how many radio interviews have we done with famous doctors over the years talking about testicular cancer and prostate cancer, talking about health and kidney health and all that sort of stuff. And then we stick our heads in the sand and go, well, that's other people, that's not for me to worry about. I always thought I was going to keel over from being too overweight and would regularly get my cholesterol checked. And then during one of those cholesterol checks, they said, oh, your PSA is a bit high, and that's a 7. It should be sort of 0.02 or 0.3 or 0.05. So we're going to get you referred to a specialist. And that's when they told me that it was cancer. And that was over a year ago now. This is my second Christmas of basically being cancer-free. So look, it's definitely worthwhile.
Well, I'm really pleased. And I'm glad that you've absolutely turned the corner. And the great thing about you is that you kept working all the way through it. And the other great thing about you is that you were willing and happy to share the story with other people. And of course, they've given you right back, because the waves of love and support for you that came from here in the UK, where people know you, and in Australia too, were amazing. We're talking with John O'Coleman. As you've been hearing, there's a terrible phone line. So what we're going to do is we're going to fire some commercials just now, and we're going to try and call him back and try and reconnect with John O'Coleman in Sydney, Australia, where it's already Christmas Day.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
It's worth it just for the classic hits you hear here. Howard Hughes here, WJ Smith in the US. It's not quite the unexplained we're doing tonight. We're kind of talking around Christmas and various other things. And also, you know, we'll work in a bit of weirdness along the way, because that's, you know, that's the way we are. So I hope you're enjoying it. If you want to come on and talk with us about Christmas where you are, WJ, it'd be nice to hear from you. It's, I think if you're calling from the US, it's 001. Then you drop the first zero, so it's 001-344-499-1000 if you want to come and talk to us about what it's like in the US. We're trying to get back to John O'Coleman in Sydney, trying to get a better line with him, because there were a couple of things that we wanted to talk with him about also. And Elfed, thank you for your text, regular listener to The Unexplained. I'm very pleased about that. I didn't get the other two, though, Elfed. So if you can send me the other two texts, or just, you know, consolidate them, if that's the word, into one, then I can deal with it appropriately. I don't know where they went. I've got a screen here that's full of material, and I can't see if where they are. But, you know, if you want to just send them again, then I'll see what we can do. Because, you know, we're that kind of people. So it's just myself, Sam doing the technicals, Karen on the production here. We're going to reconnect with Australia. If you want to talk with us tonight about what Christmas is like for you at the moment, has somebody made your day already and it's not even Christmas Day by doing something great, like that train guard when I was trying to go home last night and there was no guard for the train, so a guy who'd come off shift, was going home, said, I will pilot this train back, and all of these people, I'll make sure they get home on the last train of the night. And that guy's name, I think he was Spanish, that was the accent I picked up. I'm never going to know who that was, but he saved all of us an awful lot of hassle and possibly a replacement bus service. And you know what that's like. I think we can reconnect with Jono. Can we reconnect? Yes, I'm getting the thumbs up from Karen. Jono, can you hear me? Yeah. Come in, Sydney.
Yes, come in, Sydney. Come hearing in you loud and clear, Howard. It's funny because I came rushing down from the rooftop because you were coming through. You were coming through loud and clear on my mobile phone
that's
device.
Just me, yeah?
And then I heard that you were getting a bit of, I mean, can you imagine the number of people? I'm talking to you now on like a sort of digital phone that I get with my internet service. And I was talking to Karen, well, I was trying to, I could hear her, and she's going, I can't hear him. I'll try calling back. And I'm going, it's me, I'm here, me, I'm here, Karen. And anyway, so we're back online. You are live to Rushcutters Bay in Sydney, Australia, boiling hot, sunny day.
Hang on, are you in the middle? Because the phone line was not that great, I was getting sort of every third word at the end of that. Are you in the middle of your move then? You haven't quite finished the move, is that right?
That's right. We haven't quite finished the move. We're using digital phone technology at Rushcutters Bay at Palm Beach, the new house. We haven't actually got a phone on there, so we're just using our mobile phones, and we're waiting for the internet to be hooked up, which is happening on the 28th of December. So it's crazy because, you know, Sydney is full of people from all over the world coming for a sort of Bondi Beach kind of Christmas. So that's why so many phone lines get sort of used up. And then on New Year's Eve, you can imagine what it's like with people sending photographs and video images everywhere. That's why the phones get sort of super stressed out at Christmas time and New Year's Eve.
And we haven't got to forget that 20 years ago, the only way to connect was to use an expensive phone line. And, you know, you had to talk and you had to watch the minutes because otherwise you'd be needing to get a mortgage. So, look, you talked about Bondi Beach Christmas and stuff like that. I've been lucky enough to spend a couple of Christmases in the Southern Hemisphere in Africa. And it's a completely different, it's a strange, for those of us from the Northern Hemisphere, it's a bizarre experience because you go past shops that have got snow sprayed all over the windows, but it's 32 degrees or 34 degrees. I was in a place called Pietermaritzburg in South Africa, and walking down the high street was Santa Claus. It was 36 degrees. He was in all the gear. So it takes a bit of adjusting too, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, I only just start feeling Christmassy about 1 or 2 days before Christmas. Yesterday, we did the TV show that I'm on. I'm on that morning TV show around Australia called Studio 10, and I had to go over to the Sydney Fish Markets, which was, they do like a sort of 48-hour sort of non-stop bonanza of people buying prawns and crabs and lobster and fish and salmon and tuna, and I did a live cross because the TV station that I'm on, Channel 10, is literally across the road, walk across the road to the fish markets, which is kind of nestled on the water as well on Sydney Harbour. So it was like 28 degrees or 29 degrees like it is today. I walked across, and by the time I walked back, I felt like I'd done a two-hour gym session, and it was just manic and crazy. But, you know, it's a sort of Sydney tradition, that sort of seafood, and people get their turkey and they get their ham, but they get their big stash of fresh seafood as well. And average kind of price for, you know, a kilo of prawns is about $26 this year. So they go up and down in price. But it's, you know, because it is, as you say, like in South Africa and around Australia and New Zealand, it's a warmer climate on Christmas Day especially. So a lot of British people from the UK, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, you name it, they go and have they go down to Bondi Beach or to Manly Beach, and they have a sort of chilled out Christmas at lunchtime.
Maybe a
cold salad-y lunch rather than the hot turkey and the hot this and the veggies.
Well, that's exactly, because that was the mistake I made. One year I was in the Southern Hemisphere for Christmas, and it's lovely being in the sunshine. You know, what's not to like? And you're listening to radio on the internet from London and thinking, I don't want to be there now. But I made the mistake of having the turkey and all the trimmings and the bread sauce and everything. And that's fine while you're eating it. But once you've finished it and it's 36 degrees of heat, it's a whole other experience. So I think the seafood is a much better bet, I would say, Jono. So
yeah, a lot of people in Australia have a sort of a warm nighttime meal. So like they'll have supper at about 5 or 6 o'clock, and then they might have some hot turkey and Brussels sprouts. And some people have the traditional English lunch of you know, with the Christmas crackers and the turkey and the ham and the everything and the stuffing. We sort of do that, but we also combine it with, you know, sliced turkey and things that Margot's been slaving over since yesterday, and my mum's recipe of English kind of stuffing on the side, and then salads, and then prawns and crab and lobster and oysters. It's madness. Then we get ready for the Queen's speech, of course, and it's quite traditional, sitting there in your silly paper hat doing a few Russ and Jono type jokes from the Christmas crackers.
Just get the plug in there again. I mean, is Christmas exactly like it is here, or are there things that you do in Australia that we don't do here at Christmas?
It's probably to do with Sunday is the test down at Melbourne Cricket Ground. It's the Sunday Boxing Day test, which is very famous at the Sydney the Melbourne Cricket Ground. So Melbourne's a big day for cricket on Boxing Day after the big Christmas at home in Melbourne and Sydney, and also because, you know, Australia is primarily very much a part of the British Empire, and so there is a lot of people like us, immigrants, who came here in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. So there still is a tradition of a British style European Christmas, but there is a very big Asian population too, people from China and Hong Kong and Vietnam and Malaysia and Singapore. So there's a lot more variety in sort of kind of satay food or Japanese-style cold fish and, you know, sushi and things like that. But they still have the Queen's speech on the telly. We still have the... You put on the ABC TV and you've got the choirs from, from Cambridge or, wherever those beautiful... choral concerts come from at the BBC broadcast. We get all that. We get the non-stop footage of what the Queen and the royal family are up to, going to and from Balmoral, and so it's similar. And then, as I said, Boxing Day in Sydney is very much people switch on the TV, or if you're lucky enough to live where we are, you look out on the balcony and there's the Sydney to Hobart yachts all steaming out of the harbour on their way to the start line. So they spend the next 3 days going down the coast. And this year they're saying it's such incredible weather, it's going to be a bit of a doddle for most of them, whereas in past years there have been very bad storms. And, you know, 1 year specifically there was quite a few people lost at sea who went overboard, and quite a few members of a very famous British sailing family were lost at sea during one of the Sydney to Hobart yacht races. So it's tinged with a lot of history, that race.
People like yourself, John, you plan well in advance for your life and your career into 2019. What are you going to be doing in the new year? What's the plan?
I'm going to be nipping back to London at some stage early in the year to see Russ, because we're going to do some more recording together and do some more Russ and Jono podcasts. And then also we're talking to a radio station, which may be actually, in fact, in that building that you're broadcasting from.
Never.
Now. And
are you allowed to talk about this? Are the negotiations at a sensitive stage?
They're so sensitive. We've already done 5 shows that haven't gone to air yet. But it's a radio station called Fix Radio, which is especially aimed at sort of tradies and people who work on building sites and things like that. So we're doing about a month of shows for them as a special thing. And I've roped in Leo Sayer, and he's on the Christmas podcast, and people like Alistair Stewart, thank you very much indeed. And it's kind of like I've got 1 foot in London and 1 foot in Sydney. So it seems that Russ and Jono have been away for long enough that people have forgotten how crap we were.
personally, John, I always thought you were very good. I mean, I thought you were excellent. I mean, you weren't as good as Chris Tarrant and the other team and myself, but, you were very good. In the day. I mean, it's nice to know that you're back.
It was a different style. I think Russ and Jono were more laddish than you guys.
Yeah, and one of these days, not now, we'll tell the story of how I very nearly came to work with you back then. And I think that may be the first time I've ever said those words on the air. But hey, it's all past now, Jono. But we had a lunch meeting. We had a secret lunch meeting, didn't we? You, Russ,
and me. I think we did some pilot programs as well. and I think you and I did some pilot programs for a talk radio format as well, if I remember correctly.
A long time ago. And I'm going to shock you now. Do you know how long ago that was? It was the thick end of 20 years.
It's good that I'm sitting down now, then.
Well, no, you'll need to. In your operation. Listen, I'm delighted that, number one, that your health is excellent now, and long may it continue that way, Jono. And I'm delighted that it's going so well for you. And when you're back here, and we always say it on Facebook Messenger, but I want to see you this time. It'd be nice.
Yeah, last time it was very hectic because Russ demanded that I spend a lot of time with him and actually did some work. And in between, taking Emily around shopping and keeping Margot, the beautiful wife, happy and entertaining a few people at the Groucho Club in Soho, it was sort of like non-stop craziness. Yes. Well, you save all year. You save all year so you can get to London and have a few good times and order a few bottles of wine and have fun with your sisters and all your aunts and uncles that are still alive. But yes, Howard, I will be coming over at some stage during 2019. It's so funny. I still go to say 1999 or, you know, sometimes
I do that too.
Old thing. Remember those things called checkbooks when you go to write something and you have to sign the date? Sometime, the other day, I almost wrote 1998, or then I wrote 2008 a couple of times.
Are you still using checks? My Australian friends in London always say to me, your banking system in your country is so out of date, but you're using checks in Australia still.
Not really. We still have the books, and Margot lets me write out a check once in a while, just so I feel like I'm getting involved.
Just so you got your own money. It's very good. It's very, 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 very good.
It's the Monopoly bank check, but I still keep in practice.
Jono, have a very happy Christmas to you, Margot, and the family, and to Banjo as well, your dog.
Yeah, I'll put some photographs up so that that you can share them on Facebook and show people how hard I'm doing it, as always. And a very Merry Christmas to you and the producers and everyone at Talk Radio. And just stay safe, and let's all keep on keeping on, as they say in Australia. And don't drink too much. And if you've drunk too much, or if you've enjoyed yourself too much, get a cab. It's worthwhile spending the money, whether you get Ubers or cabs or ring a friend to give you a lift. Don't be stupid, or get, you know, public transport, which we haven't got much public transport over Christmas and the New Year, because it's full of people from other parts of the world going, could you show me, do you know where the Sydney Opera House is, mate?
Well, it's down by the waterfront.
That's right. Look for the water, then turn left.
And you find it. Look for the ferries, look for the water, and you found it. Jono, happy Christmas. Thank you. And have a great 2019.
Yeah, same to you, Howard. Lots of love.
Take care. Bye-bye. Jono Coleman in Sydney, who's clearly doing very well. And he's had, you might have read about it in the papers here, and in Australia as well. If you're listening, if you're one of my listeners in Australia, then you'll know about this as well. Jono's done a lot of interviews about his health issues, but it's so good to hear him on great form. But then, when have I ever not spoken to John and he wasn't on good form, I think is the way that I wanted to put that. This is Howard Hughes. You're listening to Talk Radio. We're across the UK, round the world here. If you want to look at our website, it is talkradio.co.uk. But whichever road up you want to do it, it's nice to have you there.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
I just love that bit. I saw you there, just standing there, and it was Christmas Eve.
I saw you there.
Exactly. Thompson Twins. If you're very, very young, you won't remember that. Check out the music of the 80s. For some of us, the 80s haven't ended yet. Howard Hughes, right across the nation, all around the world on Talk Radio, the newest and most exciting radio station anywhere, to be perfectly frank with you. Now, I'm very excited that not only have I caught up tonight with Jono Coleman in Sydney, who's doing great, but also we're going to catch up with a couple of people who are very much a part of my radio past, on Who's Radio Show in Chicago, Illinois, which is one of the biggest and most important radio markets in the US. I have appeared on a number of times, and they've appeared on my shows, but I haven't spoken with them for at least 10 or 12 years. The people I'm talking about are husband and wife pairing Steve King and Johnny Putnam, otherwise known as Steve and Johnny, from WGN Radio in Chicago, who should be online to us from frozen Chicago right now. Steve and Johnny, can you hear me? London calling.
We can hear you, Howard. Merry Christmas.
How nice to hear your voice, Steve. And Johnny, I'm sending you love from the UK.
Thank you so much. It's just a real thrill. But you took me aback there that it's been that long since we last chatted.
Oh, well,
I can't believe that.
It's been an awful long time, because the way it used to work out is that you were doing an overnight show in Chicago, and I was doing a morning show in London. And when I'd finished my stuff in London, I would come on and talk to you, and you'd talk to me about how are things in London. And then sometimes I would phone you if there was a big freeze-up in your city, or people were moaning and whinging and whining about snow in the UK. I'd say to them, I'm going to take you to a place where it is so cold at times that if you step out at the wrong time of day, your eyebrows are going to freeze over.
Yes.
Or your nose freezes closed. But we're very lucky. Today was actually very seasonal. It was sunny, and I was running around without a coat on, believe it or not.
You're kidding.
And people were pointing and staring. Well, it was very strange.
That's a different story.
So, look, bring me up to speed with you two. Are you still doing the same time slot on the radio?
No.
No, we stopped doing our full-time show back in 2011. Now we are doing specials. We do, as we call them, drive-by shows. We'll be doing a New Year's Eve special, a six-hour-long New Year's Eve special on WGN.
Uh-huh. The only live New Year's Eve show in the Midwest and probably in the entire country, because most stations are plugging in pre-recorded programming. But
right,
we'll be live.
So you are doing live, and you're doing 6 hours of it. And we have to say that Chicago, I said it was a very important radio market. It is. It's one of the most important in the world, in fact. When you do a six-hour show in Chicago, and if it's nighttime, then people are hearing you all over North America, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Long before the Internet, we were heard in 38 states and parts of Canada.
Wow.
Just over the air. It's a 50,000-watt blowtorch, as we call it.
Blowtorch.
But now, with the advent of the Internet, as you know, people, the world is a small place these days.
Yeah.
Mm, it is. It is. And, you know, I hope I did a little bit to acquaint people in London and the UK with what you do there, because what you do there is unique. It's the shows that you did and the shows that you're doing, I'm sure, were always a talking shop. People could call and talk with you about anything, and you would listen to them.
Yes, yes. And that was, again, for 6 hours a night. And we did that full time for 27 years. All total, we've been with the radio station for 32 years now. And that entire time we've been married, which a lot of people find very hard to believe. But we always maintain, Howard, that every married couple should have a radio show, because if you want a successful radio show, you set everything aside when you walk into the studio and sit down behind that microphone. And before you know it, any of your grievances have been forgotten. And especially if your spouse has done a really good job on the radio, then you're very forgiving and you move on.
Well, look, in all the years that you've been doing this, though, together, and you know, you are, to me, you're the perfect couple. You are bookends on the radio. But everybody, I think, in relationships, in marriages, whatever, there are times when you're not having such a good time, and maybe you have a row about something. And sometimes, for you, that row might be around the time when you're going to go on air. So how do you, you know, if you've been having a disagreement about something and you step through the studio door and you sit down and the red light is about to go on, Frasier style, and you're ready to speak to Chicago and beyond, how does that work out?
The minute you step through the studio door, the row stays on the outside of the studio door.
You check it at the door.
It never, ever comes in the studio.
And it's not that we are trying to be someone that we're not and let people think that, oh, we're perfect. We just feel that, honestly, I don't think people want to hear us moaning and groaning about.
So does that mean, though, whatever it was that you were rowing about before you went on the air, when you've done your 6 hours, does that mean that you're probably too tired by the end of it to continue? Or do you start right up as soon as you leave the studio?
No, it's all gone.
It's all gone.
Plus, the other thing that we have kind of prided ourselves on, there are a lot of broadcasters that love to yell and scream and holler.
We sort of
took pride in being able to say, we may have a difference of opinion, and we would occasionally bring that difference of opinion to the show. But we wanted to show we can have a difference of opinion, we can articulate that, and I'm still madly in love with the person I'm disagreeing with.
Well, that's nice to hear. But you said that there are lots of people on air now who like to shout. I mean, we sometimes hear about Alex Jones here, for example, the so-called shock jock conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
I had Alex Jones on my show once, about 14 years ago. I think I got one question in. And I asked him one question that I thought was a fair and balanced question. And he shouted back down the high-quality digital connection line. He said, "You're just trying to accuse me of being a charlatan selling snake oil."
It sounds like a pretty accurate,
I asked him a question,
if you ask me.
And so we said thank you very much, and we've never spoken again. I can't get him on the show now. But, you know, there is a lot of that stuff going on. But you have been able to do the radio that you do as a couple just by being nice.
Well, it's also important, too, because we all of those years, you know, we've talked about many, many serious subjects, whether it was wars or politics, and there's just no point in screaming at people. Give them an opportunity. We don't have to agree with each other. That's not what it's all about. But give them an opportunity to make their case. And sometimes, frankly, Howard, they would be so stupid that they would hang themselves. So if you lay back and let them talk long enough, they've done it themselves. You don't have to make them look bad.
But actually, let me tie this in with the holidays, Howard, because in a weird way, I think a little bit of my training for these kind of discussions started as a kid when over the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, at our house, we might have people, it was a real diverse gathering of people. We might agree, we might disagree, but everybody listened respectfully, exchanged opinions, and left the evening having a good time and being friends.
And maybe learned something, too.
Hey, listen, we're doing something here for Christmas. Sometimes we do this when I'm on the air just messing around. There's no reason why you should know this, but these days, one of the things that I do, and I do on this radio station, is a show that is like, if you've heard of Art Bell, the late Art Bell.
Of course,
I do a show like Art Bell's show, both online and on this radio station. So tonight is a bit of a different night where I'm just sort of talking to friends and doing stuff like that. And on occasions like this, we try and mess about with music. Because, Steve, I know you've got a big background and a very important background in music radio in Chicago. I mean, you were, in your time in the 70s, 80s, big-name disc jockey on, I think it was at WLS that you were on.
That's correct.
Big station. I mean, you were as good a disc jockey as it is possible to get. So we're doing Beat the Intro here with Christmas records, okay?
Ooh, okay.
So,
all
Steve
right.
and Johnny, if you're up for the challenge, we're going to play you a couple of seconds of a Christmas song here now, and I want to see if you all can both identify it maybe before myself and my team do. How about that? You want to do Beat the Intro?
Okay. Sure.
Let's
hope
the phone line's clear enough to do this, and Sam, who's doing technicals tonight, let's play that song. Oh.
White Christmas, Bing Crosby.
I think that's called, we had a show here called Beat That Tune, and the guy on it used to say, I'll name that tune in two. You've just named that tune in one. God, very good. Do you want to do another?
Yes.
You don't have to. But, okay, let's, Sam, have we got another? All right, let's, the next one has to be a little more challenging, okay? All right, let's hit that song. Roy Wood and Wizard. Do you remember that? Was that song a hit in America? Roy Wood and Wizard. I wish it could be Christmas every day.
But not huge.
No.
Okay. Well, you know, nobody said this would be fair. Do you want to do one more?
Because after all, it is your radio show.
Well, exactly. All of us have somebody to answer to, and I have Karen, she who must be obeyed, producing tonight behind the glass. So if she doesn't like what I'm doing, it doesn't get done, essentially. But she's just said, let's do another. Okay, then, Karen, let's do another then, since you say it. Go on, then. Ooh. Oh, I don't know. Do you know that one, Johnny?
I know.
Steve?
No.
Is that a Phil Spector song? Or is that recent? I don't know what that is. What is it?
That sounded a little...
Who's it by?
It sounded a little too clear to be Phil Spector.
Apparently it's We Need a Little Christmas, and I don't know who that's by. That's...
I wonder which version.
Jerry Harmon.
There were several versions.
Okay. Do you know something? I've never heard that in my life before now. So you beat... Karen, who picked those songs, has beaten both of us. Yes, Karen's going to come in because we want somebody to answer for this, to be perfectly frank. So just give us a second. Karen, the producer, I'll introduce you to her, right? Karen, when was that song a hit? Was it a hit ever?
Not really. That was the Glee version.
I thought
being American, they might have known it. But initially, Angela Lansbury sang it in a musical called Mame in 1966.
Yes.
Well,
I would remember.
Well, Steve, it was on the tip of my tongue all the time. Thank you for that, Karen.
Karen, you get a lump of coal in your stack.
Listen, nobody said this would be easy, though. You know, we've got to get a bit of challenge in there. It might be Christmas. It's still Christmas Eve here and there. Talk to me about Christmas, then. What is Christmas like in Chicago? What do they do? What's different? What's special?
Well, we do a lot of decorations. In our own house, we have 8 Christmas trees because I really do like to decorate a Christmas tree. In fact, we have a year-round Christmas tree that I change each month for whatever is the holiday or the significance of that particular month.
In fact, Howard, when we first moved into this neighborhood, they thought we were drug dealers or something because we were always coming and going at weird hours of the night, and Johnny would have these different Christmas trees just morphing from the Elvis tree to the Halloween tree.
The Elvis tree.
Yes, January.
Thank you very much.
Well, there's not a whole lot going on in January, so to recognize Elvis's birth, we have the 7-foot Elvis tree, which is just lovely. But it's really become kind of a competition, and even in our own neighborhood, because we really put up a lot of lights and do a lot of decorations, and then our neighbors try to do just a wee bit more, and then down the road they do tiny bit more than that. So you realize, there is a competition going on here.
But that's one of the things that I think is a worldwide Christmas thing, that neighborhoods all over Chicago, they will have Christmas decorations. For example, after we get off the phone with you, we're heading out to dinner, and after dinner we will drive through some of the neighborhoods. Now, we could also drive downtown. The Magnificent Mile, Michigan Avenue, is just absolutely gorgeous, and that whole street is lit up right around Thanksgiving, and Mickey Mouse rides
On a float,
and he's the one who is waving his magic wand, and the lights come on down Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, so I think, and I've always thought this, I've never spent a Christmas itself. I've been in America in the weeks before Christmas, but I think you have more of a sense of magic about it all. Stephen Jolly, just hold that thought, because we'll take some commercials here. You know how we have to do those things.
Okay, sure.
From all those years in radio. And we'll come back to you. We'll talk a bit more about Christmas in Chicago with two of the biggest stars on Chicago radio for decades and decades and decades. And I'm talking about Steve King and Johnny Putnam here on Talk Radio.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
Elvis has not left the building.
Wow. We're caught in a trap.
Oh. I can't walk out. Thank you very much. Thank you tremendously. Steve and Johnny in Chicago, stars of WGN Radio, are here. We're talking about Christmas in Chicago, and I know that Steve and Johnny, you're both Elvis fans, so we thought we'd play that for you. It's not exactly seasonal, but it works any time of year, I find. Kyle, thank you very much for your tweet, by the way, the nice things you said. Nice to know that you're there. I brought my producer Karen in here, because Karen, before she was a radio producer, worked in the travel trade and used to go to America a lot. And you were telling me a story while those commercials were playing that I think Steve and Johnny would like.
Yeah, we're talking about Christmas decorations, and one of my trips over to Boston and New England early one December, we got invited up by the New England Tourist Board. They said, come out, it'll be snowy, it'll be lovely. And yeah, it wasn't snowing. Anyway, we got taken to New Hampshire, up to a place called Concord. It was our first night. And there was a really strange tradition where it was a particular night of the year where the shops had a sale, a bit like, you know, the Black Friday thing. But the longer you stayed out, the more the shops discounted their goods. So it was like a competition to see how long you dared to stay out to see if you could get a bigger bargain.
I think the phrase for that one is only in America. But there was another thing you were telling me that I think would never happen in the UK in 1,000,000,000 years. And I wonder if they do this in Chicago. What was that one, Karen?
So this was a place called Strawberry Plantations. And there were these great big huge mansions. And they were all decked out so beautifully with what my image was actually as a child as Christmas. These massive, great, big 12-foot Christmas trees all decked out. And people would go around these mansions and look at everybody else's decorations, basically.
So, you know, we are a bit more reserved than that there. Do they do that kind of thing there? You know, people are so curious. And I think the whole celebrity culture, Steve and Johnny, came from America anyway, that whole idea about seeing how the other half live. But the idea of actually going and having a look at other people's houses, you know, bigger houses and more expensive houses than yours, wow, that's a great idea.
After dinner tonight, the neighborhood that we'll be traveling through is a rather affluent neighborhood. And we will be sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic, trying to just ease our way down the street with probably hundreds of other cars that are driving along, and it's amazing. It's been going on my entire life.
And one of the things that we're going to look for, it has become a tradition. There is a house. It is a two-story house, and you look through this one living room window, and you see the base of the Christmas tree. Then on the second floor, you see a little more of the Christmas tree, and then the Christmas tree comes out through the roof of the house.
That's fantastic. I think there is one person who made the papers in the UK who put the Christmas tree through the roof. But for the Christmas tree to go through, I mean, for a start off, in America, you've got bigger trees than we've got, I think.
Bigger houses as well.
But, well, exactly. But to actually sculpt your home and put holes in the floors to accommodate the Christmas tree is amazing.
No, they don't put holes in the floor, but that's part of the magic.
I'm very pleased to hear it.
Because when you're sitting at the curb with the children, in fact, they think that it is indeed shooting right through the floor and right through the roof. But we've been told the secret that no carpentry was done whatsoever.
It's all fakery. You're going to spoil it for me then.
Smoke and mirrors.
Exactly. Smoke and Christmas trees.
I mean, smoke and mirrors.
But, you know, the one thing is that you like a show there. Now, we've got people over here who love to festoon their homes in loads of lights. But I have a feeling, as you said, and Johnny, you seem to enjoy all of this stuff. You know, you like to put on a nice light show at Christmas.
Yes. Oh, yes. And you know, we talk about trees and houses being bigger. The city of Chicago's tree is one of the biggest ones that the city's ever had in the 105 years that they've been decorating.
How big is it?
This year it's 60 foot tall, and it weighs 8,200 pounds.
60 feet?
And 60 feet. And
the mayor had a heck of a time carrying that tree.
He just dragged it down the street. No, the big deal, Howard, is that if you have a 60-foot-tall pine tree in your front yard and you would like it removed, you donate it to the city, and then the city takes the hit for the cost of removing it, which can be literally thousands of dollars to remove a tree that size. But the city will cut it down and then put it on the back of a flatbed truck and then drive it into downtown, and then you're recognized as being the family that donated the big tree.
What a nice idea that is. My mind works like this, so forgive me for this question, but you know that 60-foot tree, the municipal tree in Chicago, when Christmas is done, what happens to that tree? How do they take it down? Where does it go?
I think it probably goes to a very big landfill.
Yeah, probably.
That's awfully sad. That's a sad end to a wonderful thing. But I like that idea of driving through town, people nose to tail, all being part of the experience. That's something we wouldn't do here.
Some of the homeowners will be standing outside, depending upon the weather, and they will have candy canes for the kids because children will jump out of the cars because the cars are going so slow, and run up to see. In fact, I know one of the houses we'll go by, they actually have real reindeer that taxidermists have stuffed, and they're sitting there on their front lawn.
Well, I hope they come to the end of their natural lives first, but...
Well, there's no gunshot wounds or anything on them, so I have to believe they were just...
More than relieved to hear it. But only in America. Are you ever tempted? Have you ever been tempted in your long lives of enjoying Christmas in Chicago to go somewhere else for Christmas? Maybe you have been. And if you do, where would you want to go?
Well, we have a home in Florida, and we've kind of thought, would it be nice to walk on the sandy white beaches as opposed to the snow in Chicago? And then that idea passes, and we go to Florida in January for a couple of months.
And we just have a lot of traditions for for Thanksgiving and Christmas. We enjoy spending them in Chicago.
And our family is here, so unless we could pack them all up and take them to Florida, then we'll stay here.
Do you know, there's a very old saying in London, and that saying you probably heard, he who is tired of London, I think it was Dr. Johnson who said this, wasn't it? He who is tired of London is tired of life. Now, when it comes to radio, I've known a few people get tired of it over the years, but some of us who are diehards, it's all we've ever wanted to do. We keep doing it. We do it in different styles and formats. I've done news and music programs and stuff like this, and The Unexplained, which is like Art Bell's show.
Mm-hmm.
We just, and you're the same. We just love radio.
Right.
So as we look at it in 2018, your side of the Atlantic, what is it that you, after all of these decades of doing it, in all the ways that you have done it, and all of the things you've talked to and people you've spoken with, what is it that keeps you coming back for more?
That's an interesting question. I think one of the things that we're enjoying now, this is what we're calling the someday part of our life. You always say someday we're going to do various things. Now that we are no longer tied to a regular weekly show, we enjoy going back for specials. We've also written a book. I'm working on an album. Johnny's working on
an album.
I've been threatening to do this for years, and because before I got into radio, I spent a good decade in recording studios and on the road. In fact, you may have heard of the group Chicago.
Yes.
Some of the members of Chicago were in my last band.
Now you tell me.
And,
wow. Yeah. So, I mean, what kind of music are you going to be doing in this album? This is a surprise. All these years I've known you. It's amazing.
It's going to be just an interesting, hopefully interesting mix of things. Some of it will be roots rock oriented. Some of it will be, I just recorded a Les Paul medley because the book that we wrote was called A Little More Less, and it had to do with our 18-year relationship with Les Paul. And it's just going to be all over the map. A little jazz, a little blues, a little rock.
Maybe what you want it to be.
So yeah, this is the Les Paul who was the father of rock and roll guitar work. Yeah?
That's correct.
Wow. One and the same.
Yes.
He was a regular on our show for 18 years.
Well, you have just laid the foundations for a much longer conversation, you two. That is astonishing. Well, I wish we had the time to continue here, but wow.
Well, let's talk about it because... He is beloved around the world. We were fortunate enough to become very good friends with him, and over those years, as a night owl, he was a regular on our show.
And one of my real treasures is one of the first guitars that Les Paul learned how to play on. His mom got it from a Sears Roebuck catalog for $3.20.
It was a Christmas present for him, and he gave it to us. And we couldn't believe it, and we even saved the old packing box and the styrofoam peanuts that were in the box that he sent it in.
That is an astonishing thing.
Off the air, if Karen can give us your address, we'll be happy to send you a copy of the book, and we'd love to do a future conversation with you about that.
I think that's absolutely lovely. Let's wrap it up here and go with plan A. Steve and Johnny at WGN Chicago from WGN Chicago. Lovely to speak with you after all of these years. Please have a very happy Christmas and a wonderful 2019. Sounds like you will. God bless both of you. Howard Hughes here on Talk Radio. Coming up, more stuff for Christmas here, including Christmas in the Falkland Islands. All of that coming up right after midnight here. Stay with us.
Festive free speech with all the trimmings.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
It's just giving you a chance to, I don't know, just take a deep breath. I mean, look, it's Christmas Day now, and you need a couple of seconds just to take it all in, really, because how many months have we spent? I mean, if you're one of those people who watches, like I do, in the middle of the night, the shopping TV channels, they were preparing for Christmas from August. So we needed a pause there to take it all in. Thank you very much. The person who tweeted this, Merry Christmas, and Merry Christmas to you too. You know who you are. You've been listening to me since the 1980s when I used to read independent radio news, like the guy you've just heard here. I did. I was all over the nation doing IRN back then. And back in the days when a DJ called Mike Allen was on, I was also involved or heard on that program. National Fresh. Mike Allen was a top guy, sadly no longer with us, but had a unique voice. You should say, hello, it's Mike Allen here. And he'd get really close to the microphone and talk like this. And if you're listening in, well, actually, he was on Talk Sport. Mike Allen did Talk Sport. So you may well be familiar with him, but it was a very unique voice. And I used to read the news into his show back in the day. I've got a million radio stories, and I won't inflict them on you tonight, because it's Christmas, and we don't want to do that, and happy Christmas. But I read the news in his show, and then I'd do the weather forecast. And then he'd forget that he asked me the same question the previous week. So he'd say, so Howard, you're doing the news tonight. How do you decide what goes into the news? And I'd sit there, probably for the 8th or 10th time, and I'd say, well, it's an editorial decision, and you've got to pick the stories based on their merits, Mike. And then the next week we'd do it, or the next month when I was on that shift, and he'd ask me the same question. Lovely man, though. One of the greats. Sadly, no longer with us, but Mike, we're thinking of you here in this building where you worked for a while. Okay, among other things tonight, before we reach the end of this, and Paul Ross is here at 1 o'clock, we're going to be hearing the second part of our conversation with the woman who married a ghost, because there is more stuff that you have to hear from Amanda Teague, who married the ghost of a pirate, okay, John Sparrow. And she really believes that that is the case, and who am I to say it isn't? And she now wants to have that marriage annulled and start a pirate-free life, I think. But the second part of it, you have to hear. If you heard the first part, you ain't... what can we say? You ain't heard nothing yet, I think is what I'm trying to say. In just a moment, we're going to be finding out what Christmas is like in the Falkland Islands with Chris Keane, who's on the radio there. So we'll talk with him, and because of time zones, we had to record that. But we're doing Beat the Intro here tonight, and the team have been threatening me all night with this. Karen and Sam's doing technical production. They're going to fire a song at me that I don't know what it is, and they're going to try and get me to do this one. So I'm on the spot here. Go on, then. Is it chestnuts roasting on an open fire? That's not very difficult. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Good song, though. Wonderful voice that guy had. Okay, we're across the UK. It is 5 past midnight. We are 5 minutes into Christmas Day. And I don't know about you, if you think back to, you know, if, I mean, maybe you are a kid listening to this, and it's nice to have you on and listening if you are. When I was a kid, I used to find it impossible to sleep. I would stay awake, and I would hear my mum and dad arguing downstairs about the turkey, and how long is this going to be before this is all cooked? And we've still got soup to make. Because in those days, you know, you used to make soup with the bits of the turkey. Maybe some places they still do that, but in Liverpool we did. But I would stay awake, and I would scrunch my eyes up trying to get to sleep. And a lot of the time I would pretend to be asleep, just so that my mum and dad thought that I was safely asleep. But I wouldn't be. And maybe that's going on in your home tonight. If it is, they're going to be happy memories in the future, let me tell you. All right, let's get to the Falkland Islands now. Always wondered what it is like to be, is it 8 hours away from here, 10,000 miles, something like that, in the Falkland Islands, enjoying Christmas? Well, thanks to British Forces Broadcasting, I've linked up with Chris Keane, who does the breakfast show in the Falkland Islands, and we're going to hear from him now, talking about Christmas in the Falkland Islands. One of the places that I've always been fascinated by is the Falkland Islands. Years ago, I had the chance to work there. And it didn't work out. I ended up working in Birmingham instead. But I always wondered what it's like to work in the Falkland Islands. So the guy we're about to speak with, in my book, is very lucky, because he does. Chris Keane does the breakfast show on British Forces Broadcasting. Yes, I've worked for them as well, but then I've worked everywhere. Down in the Falklands in Port Stanley. He's a very busy guy, and he should be online to us now. Chris, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, it's been absolutely manic here over Christmas, getting prepared. But it's been fun. Like, I do like being busy. Just maybe not this busy, but it's been manic over the last 2 weeks.
Okay, what is it that you do there?
So I present the breakfast show here. So I've just come from Bahrain with BFBS, and now I've been posted to the Falklands. I'm here for a year with my wife, so I'm lucky enough to be here with my wife this time. So I present the breakfast show every weekday morning.
That's a bit of a contrast, isn't it? Because I know BFBS very well. In fact, I used to worked everywhere, but I used to work for them. And they once offered me a 2-year contract to do exactly what you're doing in various places. And one of the conditions, I don't know whether it's still the same, is that you can do, in those days they had Hong Kong and Belize, I think they still have, and all of that. So you do 18 months in other places, but you must serve 6 months in the Falklands. Is that your gig?
Well, yeah, so we're on a mobile contract, so we get posted wherever we're told to go, but we do have preferences, and believe it or not, the Falklands is definitely one of my preferences. My first gig with BFBS about 4 or 5 years ago was down here, and I spent 2.5 years on my own, and I met my wife here, and literally, it's just the most amazing place, honestly, without exaggerating, one of the most amazing places in the world. Even at this time of year, beautiful skies, beautiful sunshine, and the wildlife is incredible. So the Falklands is definitely one of my preferences.
Well, listen, you've painted a really good word picture there, because a lot of people don't know what it's like there. They think, well, from what they've seen on the telly, there's one chip shop, one little supermarket and a pub and some houses and a lot of penguins.
Yeah, no, it's so you've got Stanley, which is the capital. I think there's about 3,000 or 4,000 people that live in Stanley. And then about 45 minutes on a long, windy, potholy road, you've got MPC, which is where all the troops live, all the guys and girls in the military, plus a lot of contractors as well. And then around the Falklands, you've got what they call camp, which is loads of little settlements, so one or two houses. And then on top of that, you've then got the hundreds of islands, which some of them are, have got people living on them, which you may have seen one in the news. So Pebble Island is actually up for sale.
Pebble
That's
Island.
One of the beautiful islands here.
Pebble Island sounds like the kind of place a pirate would live. And look, is it? I presume it's a place of, you know, high seas, high winds, and shipwrecks.
Yeah, definitely. There's a really famous picture of all the shipwrecks around the Falklands, and yeah, windy all the time. Like, even though the weather is beautiful today and it's 19 degrees today, beautiful sunshine, but it's windy. It's always windy. There's never not any wind, which is a nightmare.
You know, I mean, before the Falklands conflict back in 1982, which of course brought it all to everybody's attention, the Falklands was famous for one other thing, and I only discovered this recently, but Isambard Kingdom Brunel's great ship, the Great Western, actually spent, didn't it, if I've got the right ship, didn't it spend a lot of its time lying there until it was rescued and brought back?
I'm not sure. I'd have to do the research.
Well, there's Karen. There's an edit point then. No, but there was a very famous ship, and I think it was his, and I think it was the Great Western, and it was an iron ship. And it went on car. It had a checkered history, and it ended up having some problems, and they just let it rot effectively. They used it as storage there for a long while, coal storage on the Falklands. And then there was a big campaign, I think, in the 60s to bring it back here and restore it, and that's why it's in Bristol now. So there, well, you'll be able to talk about that, if that's right, on your show.
Chris, hey, that's a good fact.
Okay, so 3, 2, 1. So, Chris, you know, Christmas there, it's 19 degrees. I'm getting this view of a windswept place where there aren't a lot of people, but it's very beautiful. What is it like for you to live and work there?
So it's kind of like, I would describe it as, I can't really describe it. It's one of those places that you just need to visit yourself. So it's very small, but it's also very big. So it depends on who you know and what they do here. So everybody knows everybody, but it's honestly, it's like that. But, especially in the military environment, because the troops are down here, so our job is to entertain them. So we get to see that side of it. But when we do get to go into Stanley and around camp and to the other islands, that's equally as beautiful. And it's just incredible. I can't really describe it any other way rather than quite odd, really.
And before Forces Broadcasting, which you're part of, arrived there, there was a tiny little radio station that still exists, Falkland Islands Broadcasting Service, and it didn't broadcast for a lot of hours, but it was very important to people there. Now they've got you, of course, 24/7 and all the rest of it. Are you a bit of a star there when you go into Stanley? Do heads turn?
I would definitely say maybe big fish in a very small pond.
Okay. Now, Christmas, you know, we've got to talk about Christmas because that's where, you know, that's where when we're broadcasting. What is the experience of Christmas there? Are you working through Christmas? How do people play it? Do they change their shifts? Does the place feel different?
So, for me, I'm working all the way through. So, I'm actually on tomorrow morning as well doing the Worldwide Breakfast Show, which I'm very excited about, and Boxing Day. So, but for the troops here, they make sure, the heads of sheds make sure that the guys and girls below them have got so much stuff to do. So you've got the panto is on at the moment, Snow White in the Land of Folk. You've got the barbecues out and about, so a lot of people expecting to have barbecues tomorrow. There's loads of carol services, there's karaoke, there's PT if people want to go to the gym tomorrow. There's the big Santa fun run, the turkey chase.
The turkey chase is famous, isn't it?
The turkey chase is very famous, so that's going on tomorrow, I believe.
OK, how does that work then? Does somebody release a turkey and you all chase it? Or is it more complex than that?
No, it's exactly like that. So somebody releases a turkey, but not a real-life turkey. It's a man dressed as a turkey.
Oh,
he
of course
legs it is. And we chase him.
OK, and there's somebody, I hope somebody's been nominated for that already, or do you pick somebody on the day?
Well, I think someone's picked on the day, and I really hope it's not me.
How fab is that? You mentioned panto, and we'll get to that in just a second, but you used a phrase that I've got to ask you about. Heads of sheds. What are the heads of sheds?
Just the COs, so the commanding officers, okay, and the officers commanding, so the big dogs down here that really do look after their guys and girls, especially this time of year. They really do understand how far away they are from their families, so they do as much as they can. They do as much as they can for the guys and girls to make it easier for them and try to forget how far away they are from their family. And then it's our job in turn to make the heads of sheds feel the same. We look after them and they in turn look after the guys and girls. So
it's all about cooperation, isn't it? Yeah, I'm getting that picture. You know, we've done extensive preparation for this. You know, we spent all of 3 minutes preparing for this conversation, Karen, my producer, and I. I understand you're in the Panto this year.
On stage, but yeah, I'm one of the guys doing the lighting. So me and my wife are doing it as a team. So she's doing all the lighting and I'm doing the sound and the projection. So we're making sure that the atmospheric side of it is portrayed to the audience, basically. So we don't have to learn any lines or make a fool of ourselves on stage. We're the side stage, making sure it looks good, basically.
And what is the Panto?
It's Snow White in the Land of Folk. So classic Snow White tale. But it's really good, actually. So the producer, Greg, who is one of the heads, said he's a major down here. And he has put so much work into this. And he's put kind of like his own little twist on things. So Snow White and the team, rather than going off to a land of make-believe, they go down to Stanley. So they go down to Stanley Castle and they come back up to NPC Castle. So it's got loads of local switches. And everyone that comes to watch it can definitely relate to it. They'll know what's going on.
Okay. I don't know what the population of the Falklands is, but it's not big. Will everybody go and see it?
It's been quite busy. So the last two nights have been really busy. Tonight is the final one. And a lot of people did come up from Stanley as well. But we're expecting the final performance to be rammed and to be the most rowdy.
Well, good luck with that then. At least they won't be thrown, if they're thrown eggs and tomatoes, they won't be coming your way in the lighting gallery. You mentioned at the beginning of this that your wife you met there, is your wife a Falklander?
No, she's in the army. So she's in the REMI and she was posted down here as OCMTW. So MTW is the Mechanical Transport Workshops. And she came into the officer's mess one evening and I clocked eyes and the rest is history. And now we're back here together.
And did you have a sort of military wedding then?
We did, yeah. It was really good. So we had a guard of honour and a lot of people. The guard of honour was purely made of people that were here at the time when we met. So they all flew to England and we had the wedding in Worcester, where I'm from.
Ah, I worked in Worcester for a long time, in Barbourne Terrace, but that's another conversation for another time. If you sound like you're a man who really loves the place. If you're in a situation, I've known some people who've worked for BFBS abroad and they've fallen in love with the places that they've worked at and they've ultimately stayed there. If you wanted to stay there, could you?
I'm not sure. I think if I said to BFBS I'd love to, I'm sure they might let me stay. But I'm not sure. Depends on what they say at the time, really. But I think I would stay, definitely. And I know Kelly would. Hmm. She loves it here.
Well, listen, I give both of you my love and best wishes from here. We're about 6,000. Is it 6,000 miles or 10,000 miles away? I can never work that out. How many miles are we away from you?
It's 8,000 miles. We found out the other day that it would take about a year and I think it's 2.5 weeks to walk, if you fancied it.
Well, I'll bear that in mind then for when I retire, which might be quite imminent, who knows. But, you know, it is a fascinating thing to be able these days to be able to speak like this in a regular kind of way, as if I was calling Hartlepool, but I'm calling the Falkland Islands. When I was a kid, the equipment is falling apart, that's the microphone going sideways. When I was a kid, the thought of doing that, you would probably have had to book the call 2 weeks in advance, Chris.
Yeah. It's a point that I made this morning with the Padre. So I've got the Padre on the show tomorrow morning. Mm. And he was saying, basically, don't leave somebody alone this Christmas. Always make sure that they're not on their own and they're in with the party. And I said to him, it's really good that this day and age we can, rather than write home, we can Skype home and FaceTime home and even get on the phone and call home. And it just makes everything a lot closer, doesn't it?
And that's very important, isn't it, for the people who are stationed there. You know, even the toughest soldier, the toughest service person, can sometimes feel homesick. So to be able to connect like that is very important, I would have thought.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one thing that I found as well when I first came down here. And even now, I'm such a homely lad, and I still feel homesick now. But when I was first down here, he was a RIC, so Resident Infantry Company. So the soldiers that come down here to basically defend the place if anything does kick off, they're like a rotation of squadrons, basically. Mm. And he said to me, listening to your show really puts a smile on my face and helps me get through this. And that made me feel, in turn, just amazing. And my homesickness just went, just like that.
And that's exactly why we do what we do, isn't it? Have you been there when there's, you know, you say when things kick off. Have you been there when there have been alerts, when perhaps the defences have been probed and tested and all the rest of it? And what if you have, what's that like?
No, I've never been here like that. Nothing happens really like that down here. Everyone, I think the news blow it up a little bit, but literally there is nothing.
Because every so often somebody in Argentina says, you know, we'd rather like to have the place back, the Malvinas, as they call it, and there's a bit of smoke and bluster, but nothing concrete is ever done. They don't send, you know, planes and warships and stuff like that to check it out.
No, definitely not. I think it's, as you say, smoke and bluster. That is literally all it is.
Oh, well, listen, have a lovely Christmas and enjoy the panto. I hope it all goes brilliantly for you, Chris. And I know we'll talk again, so thank you very much. Take care. Happy Christmas to you and Kelly.
Thank you. And you have a great Christmas.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
Do you ever get that feeling that somebody is watching you? Actually, I read a story in the paper today about some electronic device that had recalled somebody's conversation that they didn't know had been recorded at all. So maybe this song was kind of, what's that word, prophetic? Because this was the 1980s, so I always feel like somebody's watching me. That kind of stuff is happening now. It's the kind of stuff we talk normally on The Unexplained, by the way, which returns on Sunday, special edition Sunday of The Unexplained. Be here for that. Well, I tell you what, we've excelled ourselves tonight. Producer Karen, Sam on the technicals tonight, because we've done Christmas in Space with an astronaut. What else have we done? We've done Christmas in Chicago with Steve and Johnny from WGN, the husband and wife team on the radio. Lovely people. Known them for years. And, you know, want to keep knowing them for some years more. Then my old friend John O'Coleman, who was also talking about his new podcast with Russ, recreating the old Russ and John O radio shows. So he's in good form in Sydney as he moves into his new home. And we've had Christmas in the Falklands. And what else have we had? Well, all sorts of Christmas everywhere. And Christmas with you. A couple of my unexplained listeners, I believe, are joining me now. So let's start. Should we start with Susan? We'll take Susan first. Hello, Susan.
Oh, good evening, Howard. I just wanted to say a very Merry Christmas, by the way, for tomorrow.
Happy Christmas. Well, for today, Susan. We're there already.
Yes, it's today.
Unless, of course, where are you? Where are you?
No, it's. I'm in Somerset. It's all right. Okay. The day is just flying. I do apologise. It's my fault.
No, it's just not. It's absolutely fine. You must be busy.
I'm just not tired yet, but I will be in a minute.
Okay.
So, I just wanted to tell you, if I may, how much I enjoyed your show last night. I've only just started listening to Talk Radio, and I listened to your show last night, and I thought it was absolutely spellbindingly interesting.
Thank you. I mean, which bit? I mean, don't want to blow my own trumpet here, but which bit did you like best then?
Well, I thought it was all wonderful, but I particularly enjoyed listening to Mr. Paul Sinclair, the gentleman who was on the phone quite a while to you.
Isn't he good? He's the truth proof man, the man telling those stories from Yorkshire. Wow.
Oh, amazing. I had trouble getting to sleep because I was thinking about the carcasses of the animals that have been mutilated in very, very strange circumstances. And the way that Mr. Sinclair was explaining the way they've been found, you know, in their mutilated state, it really gave me food for thought because I have a bit of nursing experience. And as Paul said, you know, if you some of these sheep have had their head and neck removed from the rest of the torso. Mm. And if you would do that, Howard, you would have quite a substantial amount of
blood.
Well,
that's what he was saying. I mean, it's Christmas Day, so we'll go there another unexplained soon. So tell me quickly then, in summary. No, please don't apologise. You mustn't get... I was like this when I was a kid, and my mother always used to say to me, you spend half your time apologising for yourself. Stand up straight. You've no need to apologise for yourself. I hear my mother's voice now. So don't worry about that. How are you spending Christmas Day then, Susan? What's the plan?
Christmas Day, I had a call from a friend. I'm going to meet her in the afternoon, but most of the day I will be on my own because my parents have passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry, mine too.
They passed away quite a few years ago. Mm. I mean, the thing is, Howard, these things happen. You know, we all lose that up.
They do. I mean, it's as people keep saying to me, it's part of life, isn't it? But, you know, Christmases roll round and you just, you know, you find another way of doing things. Yeah?
Well, exactly. But I haven't really enjoyed Christmas for a long time. It really, I don't want to be a killjoy, but I think there's far too much made of it nowadays. It starts, it's in your face since September.
Yeah.
You know, and I wish we would go back to the
Well, listen,
days.
Do you do me a favour, though? Please enjoy the day. Just take a breath and enjoy the day, Susan. And I'm glad you enjoyed the show last night. And, you know, from all of us here, happy Christmas. Have a good day. Okay. That's Susan in Somerset. Let's get to Kyle, who is one of the regular Unexplained listeners in Rochdale. How are you keeping, Kyle?
Yeah, I'm not bad, Howard. How are you?
I'm very good. What's going on with you, then?
Yeah, well, I'm good. I've got to say, Merry Christmas. And also, because, yeah, I've loved the show, obviously, since I think the time you started doing it. But I'm also happy to have a go at the intro round.
All right. Sam, sorry. Here's a willing contestant here. Right, Kyle, you asked for it. So what we're doing, Christmas Beat the Intro. For Kyle in Rochdale, here is your song. Okay, Kyle, what do you think that is?
Oh, I've got such a blank, and it's the most obvious one ever.
Because I was just about, you know, I've got to try and keep myself back, hold myself back from this. I was about to scream, "It's Merry Christmas, Everybody" by Shaky.
Well, I was going to say, Howard, it's probably Merry Christmas.
Snow is falling all around us. You remember that?
Well, I struggled. Do you know what? I did something yesterday with Jamie East, and I struggled so hard.
Well, we all do.
That completely went out of my head. But yes, I'm happy to go.
Listen. Funny you should talk about this now, because we've got just about enough time to try another one. So if you're up for it, only if you're up for it, Kyle.
I'll give it a go.
All right,
I'll
go then, Sam. All right.
That's got to be Mariah Carey and the Christmas thing she always does.
With a fab video from the mid-90s. Hey, fab video from the mid-1990s. I tell you who does a great version of that, if you get the chance to hear it. If you like a more laid-back version of that, and I will not have a word said against Mariah Carey. I love Mariah Carey, and I love that song. Michael Bublé does a great version of that, if you've ever heard it, Carl.
No, I've never heard that. Oh, get that. Thank you.
So, listen, that's part of our public service here at Talk Radio, Kyle. Kyle, listen, let me say to you, thank you very much for being such a great supporter of The Unexplained and my work on the radio. It's great to have people like you there, and I hope you have a great Christmas and a terrific 2019.
Oh, brilliant. And you too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's Kyle, regular listener of The Unexplained. The Unexplained, of course, here, 10 p.m. Sunday nights on Talk Radio. It will return next Sunday night with a special for the new year. And also go to my website, theunexplained.tv, because Adam, my web guy, will have posted the latest edition of my podcast by now. And also a brand new website coming soon for the new year. We're working on that. And yes, finally, it is coming out for the new year. Brand new website, theunexplained.tv. Just very quickly, it's not like me to make a factual error, is it? No. Says my team. I mentioned in that conversation that we recorded with the guy in the Falklands that there was a ship, very famous one, one of Brunel's ships, that actually spent some of its latter days basically lying in harbour in the Falklands, and it was used as coal and fuel storage. And I thought it was the Great Western or the Great Eastern, and Carol tells me that it was the SS Great Britain. Of course, I don't know where I was, but you're absolutely right, Carol, and thank you very much. That ship was restored after decades of lying there in the Falklands and brought back to the UK and is now fully restored and in Bristol, and fabulous to see. Carol, thank you for that. My name is Howard Hughes. This is Talk Radio.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
Howard Hughes, Talk Radio, Christmas Day. We're into it now. Maybe you're still up packing presents, whatever you're doing. I hope it's going well for you. And I hope you haven't had a row yet. I told the story the other night when I was on air here about my mum and dad. My mum and dad were the loveliest people. But every Christmas Eve, they'd be doing the turkey. And they would make, in those days in Liverpool, you made soup from the turkey as well. See, everything got used. But it was a big effort. And as kids, we didn't realise it. But every Christmas Eve, my lovely parents, who were the nicest people, 364 days of the year, would have a blazing row. So I hope that's not you now. And maybe this is helping. If I speak in a calm voice, it's all going to be okay. All right. Now, we're going to talk about something that we always used to talk about back in the day, and I think people still talk about now, but maybe not quite in the same way. The question is, what's on telly this Christmas? And is it better this year than it used to be? Is it worse than it used to be? Are there more repeats? What sorts of shows make the cut on Christmas Day and all the other days? Well, the man who knows this is Talk Radio's own TV expert, regularly heard on here, Mike Ward. Everybody thinks that they're an expert on television, and at Christmas time it becomes even more acute. And the first shots in this particular battle were fired, I think it was by the Daily Mirror, having a go at the BBC for the amount of repeats apparently they've got scheduled this year. I don't know whether you... Do you think that was the beginning of the debate?
If there's anything worse than the story, the annual story about the number of repeats on the BBC, it's the fact that that story itself is the most lazy repeat. But we all
That's
do it.
The biggest repeat of the lot
as well. I've written that story and said it, you know, so season of forgiveness all round. But you know, it isn't anything terribly new. But here's a point. I mean, the problem is the BBC has an awful lot of airtime to fill. You know, we sort of forget the fact that now, back in, you know, the 70s, 80s or whatever, we didn't have television all day long, you know, round the clock. We weren't sort of, and we didn't have as many channels as we do now. So it was quite easy to have a much higher proportion of original content. Whereas now, TV is dawn till dusk. Well, it's beyond that, obviously. You know, there's BBC Four as well. There's so much competition elsewhere. And if the BBC, I mean, if you turn that story on its head, if the BBC were putting brand new commissioned output out at, I don't know, 10 o'clock on Christmas Eve morning, there'd be uproar about that as well. Because, you know, obviously there are parts of the schedule, parts of, you know, the viewing day, when you wouldn't dream of putting out new stuff because it would be completely wasted and completely lost. Mm. It would be a daft idea.
And people would be saying, of course they would be. I mean, I have to declare an interest here. I also work for them. And I get to see all of these stories from the other side. But there would be people who would be jumping up and down and saying, what are the BBC spending millions of pounds on stuff that nobody will see and will never be repeated? So I guess to some extent, although we take the point about repeats because there are people who say, I've seen it before, and I even get that on stuff that I do. If I repeat an interview, they say, I've heard that one before, don't want to hear that one again. But I think the repeat thing, Mike, and what do you think, when it comes to television, plays to something in the British psyche. Actually, there is something kind of warm and reassuring if we see the Morecambe and Wise Christmas special with the singing, dancing newsreaders and Glenda Jackson and Shirley Bassey again. And, you know, Open All Hours Christmas special and another Only Fools and Horses repeat.
Exactly. I think, and the thing about Christmas TV is we have a slightly distorted perspective on Christmas TV and a sort of unrealistic level of expectation, particularly if you're of a certain generation. You've grown up with Christmas TV being the big thing. You know, your double issue of the radio or the TV Times, and you know the old habit in days gone by of getting it early and getting your marker pen out and putting a ring around all the programs you're planning to watch and probably will never get around to watching. But actually, the best TV is not really on at Christmas. What Christmas does is it, as you rightly say, it sort of offers a cozy, comforting familiarity. So, for example, you know, tomorrow night, BBC One, Christmas Day, it's not the greatest evening of telly. It's ticking those boxes. So you've got Strictly Come Dancing Christmas special. You've got Call the Midwife, etc. You know, increasingly popular these days, Mrs. Brown's Boys. These are shows that are on, you know, at EastEnders for an hour. It's pretty much everything feels as if it's the same as last year and the year before.
Yeah, well, and it does. And there's nothing there that is not stuff that we usually see. In other words, different versions of programs that we usually get. There are no actual specials then, are there?
Well, there's sort of specials in the sense that...
I mean specials that are commissioned specially for Christmas and, you know, will not be part... You know, Mrs. Brown's Boys is on 52 weeks of the year somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, ITV, to be fair to them, have got a Torville, it's drama Torville and Dean, two-hour drama, Christmas night, 9:15, which is in that slot that was previously, you know, Downton Abbey for several years, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I'll take your point, exactly. So it's not doing anything radically different. And I think that the problem is, and you know, all TV channels suffer this to some extent, but the BBC in particular, because of the nature of the BBC, what it is, what it represents, and how it's funded, the fact is there are a certain proportion of the population who just love a good moan, and there's nothing more, there's no, you know, whatever. And I have all sorts of misgivings about certain elements of the BBC and certain elements of I love certain elements that drive me nuts. But, you know, there is no easier target. And for as long as, the BBC remains funded the way it is, there will be no easier target for the people who just like to sort of get up in the morning, have a cup of tea and discover what to, you know, what they want to moan at.
Be disgusted of Tenter than in Kent or wherever. Yeah, I quite get you on that point. ITV is changing, though, because, of course, years ago we lost all of the individual regions. It's now one single channel, apart from Scotland, that has some degree of autonomy. Northern Ireland fell in with the ITV1 thing this year. Does that make a difference to the way that Christmas is, you know, looks on ITV?
I think Christmas on ITV has largely been a case of waving the white flag of surrender for some years now. Maybe that's a bit harsh, but if you look at the Christmas TV schedules of, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, it felt as if it was more of a level playing field in terms of what each of the main terrestrial channels were coming up with in terms of, you know, competition. Now it feels as if ITV has said, well, you know, do we really need to throw quite so much at Christmas TV? Most, you know, the viewing habits are such that people tend to watch, you know, switch the TV onto BBC One and leave it there anyway, possibly while they're sort of slumping in an alcoholic coma in the corner of the room, you know, after too many sherries. But it's as if ITV is sort of saying, well, there's only so much money to go around. It doesn't make sense to go that mad about Christmas. So you'll get a lot of the soaps obviously are huge, for example, and there's an awful lot of that. But there are no major sort of dramatic risks, if you like, on ITV over the Christmas period, I wouldn't say.
You're probably not comparing like with like, really. But, you know, I tend to think that the great Christmases, and we're all bound to say this, were the ones when I was younger. So I'm talking about sort of 70s, 80s, maybe early 90s, when you could always guarantee that you would split your sides with Only Fools and Horses because they'd always come. The pressure on them must have been enormous. And then, of course, that in my parents' generation, and when I was littler, if that's a word, there was Morecambe and Wise and poor Eddie Braben, about whom there was a drama this year. The writer of Morecambe and Wise shows, you know, be having heart attacks, almost did have one, I think, creating those shows every year.
Yes, it was a massive, massive burden of expectation because Morecambe and Wise, for a period in the 70s in particular, their last Christmas show, I think, was 1983. Sadly, Eric died in 1984. But you were talking about a sort of 10-year period where the pressure on Morecambe and Wise and on, as you say, on Eddie Braben, the main writer, was enormous because, you know, that was the day of that communal viewing experience. You know, this is before satellite and digital TV. This is before, you know, even Channel 4 didn't come on air to the early 80s. So, we had three TV channels and we didn't have other distractions. We didn't have DVDs or the internet or whatever. So watching TV then, and you know, it sticks in the memory now, was such a communal experience. It was such a family thing. You gathered around your set. You didn't really have the option to record something and watch it later. It was an appointment to watch something at a certain time. And inevitably that sticks in the memory. We possibly have slightly rose-tinted spectacle view of it to some extent. But, you know, having said that, the quality was there because it was tapping into people's expectations and largely satisfying those expectations.
Right. And do Sky One, Sky Atlantic and the other channels in that bouquet, if that's the right word for it, do they approach Christmas in a different way or do they try to take on BBC One, ITV, BBC Two, Channel 4 in the same way?
They approach it a different way. I mean, they approach TV all year round in a different way. And particularly, you know, Sky is very much into the idea, which, of course, the BBC is now picking up on to a greater extent with its with the iPlayer, of actually putting out an episode of something, a new series, and then making the whole lot available in one go on, as a download or such like. Yeah, our viewing habits are now such that all year round, they're very different. You very rarely now, well, I say rarely, but increasingly rare, now, and it's increasingly rare to have a series that will go out once a week, a six-part series, for example, or something that will go out every Tuesday at 9 o'clock. Obviously, it still happens quite a lot, but increasingly now, we'll get these series stripped across the week. Now, I mean, you've got Luther, for example, Idris Elba coming back in Luther on BBC One New Year's Day, and that's just going to be a four-part series each night that week, and that's it. That's the series done and dusted in 4 nights. We've got a new series called Manhunt coming on ITV the week after that. Again, 3 nights on the trot. That's done and dusted. Because the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime Video and other such services are now have changed the way so many people want to consume TV. They want everything there, in, you know, to consume at their pace, at their leisure, and they don't want to be tied down, you know, to the schedules and sort of have their lives controlled by the whims of the schedulers.
It is interesting the way it's all changing. I noticed the way that the BBC rolled out The Little Drummer Girl recently. They didn't put episode one out and then all the other episodes on the iPlayer for TV. They made you wait for it. And in a way, that was good. That was like old-fashioned TV, because I was building up to, you know, what is going to happen to Florence Pugh next week. And then maybe I watched them again on my phone, you know, if I missed any nuances, because I thought it was a superb drama. But that's kind of harking back to the old ways, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I mean, I think the you know, I speak from a slightly old-fashioned perspective on this, but I do think we live in a world of such instant gratification now that you know I want to read a book, I'll download it in a matter of seconds. I want to watch a film, I'll find it online, download that. Because you get everything very, very easily, it's tempting to suggest that actually you don't tend to appreciate it. It's a bit like it's a bit like when you're never experiencing appetite, enjoying a meal, but never actually being hungry beforehand. You know, when you go out for a lovely meal or you go for dinner at somebody's house, part of the experience is the anticipation, is the build-up, is the hunger, is this sort of, you know, what's going to happen, what we're going to get, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're constantly fed stuff and it's screaming at you for every direction, you know, watch me, binge watch me, no, don't watch that, watch this, it gets a point where I think some of the pleasure of that anticipation is taken away. So for as long as there are dramas that still hold stuff back, I think that's still a nice option to have. And I think it's quite nice to look forward to things in a slot, in a particular set time, in a set place, to this day. I still think there are viewers who want that option.
Well, you're looking at him. He is one of them. Okay, this is a question that you're going to get asked over this festive period 1,000 times by people who do interviews like the one I'm doing now. For you, what are the nuggets across this festive season then? What are the things that we really need to look out for in the schedule?
Well, very often, I think the best things are actually immediately after Christmas, because everybody's household is different. And I've always argued that Christmas Day is a really bad day to watch TV for a lot of people, because you've got the family round, you're going to visit people coming to visit you, you've got the, you know, big Christmas meal, you've got presents, et cetera, et cetera. I've never quite understood, you know, and I can't speak for everyone, so it wouldn't be fair to, I've never quite understood why people have got endless hours just to watch the telly, and, you know, without distractions. So Boxing Day, for example, we have another of these Agatha Christie adaptations, which the BBC have taken to doing recently in the festive season. This is the ABC Murders, which is going out at 9 o'clock on Boxing Day, and then for the next 2 nights after that.
I've been reading about this. They've chucked some money at this one.
Yes, absolutely, and it's good. John Malkovich plays Poirot, but it's a very different take on Poirot from David Suchet playing him for ITV. This is dark, much darker, more intense, I'd argue. I mean, obviously, all murder mysteries are dark by definition, but you know what I mean? It has a certain
style. No, I get what you're coming from.
So that makes it a little bit different. So I've only watched the first episode, but I certainly will be watching the rest of that. It's got a sort of old-fashioned, very true to Agatha Christie's style. But as you say, they're throwing a lot of money at it. And it's very stylish and it's very addictive. And I think that's going to get a good response.
And John Malkovich, I think that sounds quite inspired as a choice.
Yeah, it is an interesting choice. He plays him as Poirot past his peak, as it were. And you've got Rupert Grint in there from Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah.
Almost unrecognisable, playing Inspector Chrome, who's the police officer in charge of this murder investigation, who has very little time for Poirot at all. He's very sceptical as to his, his credentials.
Well, just as well, he's very different. You'd have Hagrid turning up saying, well, I think we need to be investigating a little case of murder here, Harry Potter.
Well, having said that, I haven't seen episode two, so let's not rule that out entirely.
It may happen, who knows. I also saw that the BBC and Netflix are doing a version. Have I read this right? Putting out a version of Watership Down.
Watership Down, yeah. Watership Down is coming out on Saturday, the 29th of December. So that's going out on, I think it's somewhere 7 o'clock. I'm just having a look at my notes here. Let's see if I can find it. I can't find it.
Well, listen, this is great that we have the internet, though, because we can just say to people, just put it into a search engine. We know the day, and you'll find the time from there. Don't worry about that. But that sounds to me to be extraordinary, because it's one of those things where they take a bit of a risk. The original was so iconic. How can you do that better?
How can you do it better? Well, I guess one of the key factors is that technology now, and the sort of, I don't necessarily understand the ins and outs of the technology, but computer graphics effectively can make those rabbits look very, very real, and in a way that sort of is quite adds a sort of depth to the story, because they become characters. Yes, they're talking rabbits. It's slightly bizarre, but it doesn't take long before you become completely and utterly absorbed in that as a concept.
I had to hold myself back then. I was very nearly singing Bright Eyes. You don't want to hear that, especially on Christmas Day. Howard Hughes here. Coming next, more on Christmas television with Mike Ward on Talk Radio.
Howard Hughes on Talk Radio.
Christmas Day on Talk Radio. We're talking with Mike Ward, TV expert. And the question is then, what are the main highlights then? What else is on television across this Christmas period this year?
One thing I would particularly recommend, just coming after Christmas, a new two-part series called Billy Connolly, Made in Scotland. This is on BBC Two on Friday the 28th and finishing the following Friday. But Billy Connolly, I don't know if you saw, a couple of weeks ago, made a one-off documentary for ITV, looking back on the travelogues he's made, the TV travelogues he's made over the last 25 years.
It was such an ear and eye-opener for me to see and hear Billy. I love Billy Connolly. Loads of people do. To be reminded of those trips that he made.
Yeah, extraordinary. And, of course, we're so used now to seeing celebrities being sent off on these kind of these jaunts around the world. Sometimes they're not entirely, shall we say, convincing. You feel as if they just pointed a camera at something and effectively, always isn't that pretty without any great deal of sort of passion or research. But Billy Connolly always threw himself into those experiences like you wouldn't believe. And consequently, they were great fun. But what we're watching on this other series, this new one called Made in Scotland on the Friday nights on BBC Two, is looking back on his career as a stand-up comedian. So he goes back to, he lives in Florida these days, as you'll have seen on the ITV thing. He goes back to Scotland and particularly to Glasgow for this series, and he wanders around some of his old haunts. So it's about comparing, to some extent, the place he grew up with how it's become, and which elements of it have changed, which elements of it remain the same.
Well, listen, I can remember going and doing a journalistic training course in the 80s in Glasgow, and then going back to train them years later. In the early 2000s, and the city had changed and transformed enormously. So this is going to be a voyage of discovery, I think.
Oh, yeah, it is. And it's fascinating to see, because he was a welder, he worked on the docks, and he talks about how that shaped him and to a large extent shaped a lot of the character of the city. But also he talks about his career as a stand-up comedian, how he decided to make that leap, because he started off being predominantly a folk musician, doing a little bit of comedy in between the songs, joined up with Jerry Rafferty of Baker Street fame initially.
Yeah, we forget about that era, don't we? In the mid-70s, you had Mike Harding in Manchester, Jasper Carrot in Birmingham, Max Boyce in Cardiff, and Billy Connolly in Scotland.
Yes.
And a guy that, I haven't heard of him recently. I don't know what happened to him, but there was a guy called, Richard Digance in London.
Mm. Yes.
If you remember,
exactly.
I mean, that's going back a bit. But everybody had, there was each region had its own person.
Yeah, and it was that sort of comedic folk approach to things. So there was the music and the comedy element were balanced in their acts, predominantly towards the music in most cases. But in Billy's case, you know, he talks about how he'd still, as the comedy became more and more a part of his act, he'd still bring the banjo on stage almost as a security blanket, but he'd just leave it propped up by the side. And eventually he decided not to bring it on stage at all. And then we talk about, you know, his appearance on Parkinson famously and how that sort of helped, you know, spread the word as to, you know, the sort of bunch of us. But it's fascinating because you also hear input from people like Eddie Izzard, Tracy Ullman, Ross Noble, various people who understand, you know, the comedy world and how he was so pivotal in changing it from, you know, the old-fashioned, you know, mother-in-law style gag to what I guess became evolved into the alternative comedy, you know, revolution of the 80s.
Well, I have to say, Billy Connolly told two of the most amusing side-splitting jokes of my lifetime. And when I think about them, even though I've heard them a million times, they still make me laugh, neither of which I can tell you here, even though it's late at night. I mean, just a genius, absolute genius, and a natural one, too.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I've only ever been to see him once, but and I've been to plenty of, you know, stand-up comedy gigs over the years. He is the only person I could honestly say has left me laughing uncontrollably, you know, in agony. Because there is a natural style. Yes, of course, every stand-up works to a script to some extent, but you knew with Billy that he veered from that sort of the structure every time he performed, and there was that natural sort of improvisational element within it,
but it was always silly. It was never dirty. It was never controversial. But I do remember one of the funniest things he did, and people don't talk about it now. You might remember this, Mike. He came onto the stage on a TV show, and it might have been the Palladium, and he had dangling from the zipper of his trousers, apparently. What it turned out to be was a sausage. But, of course, from a distance, if you're in the audience or you're watching on TV, it didn't look like a sausage. It might have been something else. And he walked out on stage. People took a gasp. Then he took a pair of scissors out of his pocket and cut the thing off. And people went, that was the start of his act. It wasn't even the middle of it. Oh, Lord. I'm sorry.
Yeah. He also talks about how he has no truck with organized religion and on from whatever perspective. And obviously, there was a time when his act was he told a famous crucifixion joke, which he talks about in this program, which didn't exactly go down well with certain elements of the community. And he was leafleting, you know, the people protesting outside his gigs and, you know, calling for him to apologize. And of course, the more they called for him to apologize, the more he thought, no. This is the last thing I'm going to do, because obviously that was, you know, the antithesis of what he was attempting to do. So yeah, anyway, that is a brilliant thing to watch. And talking of comedy, also on Boxing Day, worth mentioning on BBC Two again, these Morecambe and Wise, as we were talking about earlier, The Lost Tapes, which is two old Morecambe and Wise episodes from 50 years ago, 1968. They were discovered bizarrely in a derelict cinema building in Sierra Leone. These two, yes, exactly. Why didn't they think of looking there before?
Sierra Leone. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. And they were in black and white. So basically, what's happened is I sadly haven't been able to see this because the previews haven't been made available at the moment. But basically, they're in black and white, and they've used the digital colorization process, which has been applied to a number of things these days, to restore them to the color. You know,
what a wonderful thing that will be, because 1968, we will both remember, they were on the cusp. They were with Lou Grade's ATV, which was ITV. And the shows then transferred in 69 to the BBC and went into colour. And they eventually got Eddie Braben on board. And he changed the nature of their act. He changed the kind of people they came across as. Did things like got them to sleep in the same bed. And they were uneasy about it, weren't they? And Eddie Braben said to them, well, if it was good enough for Laurel and Hardy, it's good enough for you.
Yeah.
So we're going to see, 1968, we're going to see Morecambe and Wise just at a tipping point for them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Wow. I gather Michael Aspel is a guest of one of them, one of the episodes they show. And before that, that's at 10 to 8, Boxing Day, BBC Two, the two episodes. That runs till 9 o'clock. Before it, there's a rerun of the 1971 episode, which is the one with Andre Previn doing the Grieg's Piano Concerto sketch, and Glenda Jackson is on it, Shirley Bass is on it. So that's, you know, a classic for all sorts of reasons.
I used to interview Glenda Jackson when she was MP for Hampstead a lot, when I was on, you know, Capital Radio London, stations like that. And I used to get on really well with Glenda Jackson, and we'd always talk about that. I mean, she, even though she will have seen it a million times, and I've seen it half a million times, you know, she still loved it.
Yeah, it is. You know, I don't know what at all. You know, somebody in their teens.
Festive free speech with all the trimmings.
Happy Christmas to you all.
Christmas on Talk Radio.